Nietzsche, His Life and Works, Anthony M. Ludovici. Listen to and download free AI-generated audiobooks at 3ords.com, the Project Gutenberg ebook of Nietzsche, His Life and Works. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg license included with this ebook or online. www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. Title: Nietzsche, His Life and Works. Author: Anthony M. Ludovici. Author of introduction, etc. Oscar Levy. Release date: October 11, 2016. Ebook 53,260. Most recently updated: October 23, 2024. Language: English. Other information and formats: www.gutenberg.org/ebook/53,260. Credits: produced by Mark de Hooghet. Free literature online soon, in an extended version, also linking to free sources for education worldwide. MOOCs, educational materials. Images generously made available by the Internet Archive. Asterisk start of the project. GUTENBERGEBOOK Nietzsche, His Life and Works. Asterisk Nietzsche, His Life and Works, Philosophies Ancient and Modern. By Anthony M. Ludovici, author OF, Who is to be Master of the World? And Notes to Zarathustra, preface by Dr. Oscar Levy, Constable and Company Limited, London, 1910, introduction, the commission for a book on Nietzsche to form the latest edition to a series of famous philosophers is most certainly a sign that the age of adversity through which the earlier Nietzscheans had to struggle has at last come to an end. For 10 consecutive years, they had had no reply whatever to their propaganda, and their publications, loud as some of them were, proved as ineffective as cannon shots fired into the eternity of interplanetary space. Finally, however, when the echo was at last heard, it gave back nothing like the original sound. It was an echo of groans and moans, an echo of roaring disapproval and hissing mockery. Yet the years rolled on and on, and so did the printing presses, hissing and roaring as much as ever. But at last, their thunders grew tamer and more subdued. The tempest of their fury seemed to die away in the distance. Occasionally, a slight mutter was still to be heard, but no more flashes and hisses, and suddenly, a streak of blue was observed over the horizon, followed by a ray and smile of sunlight, and a soft zephyr of subdued and tentative compliments. And when our Nietzsche edition had begun to appear in its stately volumes, we were enabled to receive from our former enemies on both sides of the Atlantic, respectful congratulations. And now all my brave friends are radiant with joy and optimism, like the wanderer in the fairy tale, while the storm of disgust and loud reproach was raging, they wrapped themselves all the more closely in their cloaks, and no impudent wind could tear a shred of garments from them. But now that the sun of approval has set in, they would fain get out of their armor and enjoy the fine weather as a reward for past perils. Has not the spring come at last? Are not the gay flowers at our feet meant to welcome the victorious warriors? Are not the ladies, ladies that from time immemorial have loved the warrior, especially when he is successful, smiling at us more gloriously even than the sun? Sun, ladies, flowers, smiles, was there ever a nicer combination? But alas, there is an unimaginative creature among the guests, an earnest face among the cheerful, a disbeliever among the faithful, a dark countenance amid the bright, being who, in glaring contrast to the sun, the smiles and the gaily colored dresses and sunshades, is keeping a tight hold upon a dark umbrella, for he has an uncontrollable mistrust of English weather. And I may claim that I not only know the meteorological conditions of England, but also those of the whole of modern Europe. I know them so well that I have the greatest doubts whether Nietzsche's influence will be strong enough to withstand the terrible hurricane of democracy, which in our age is sweeping everything before it and leaving a level plain in its rear. Nietzsche may have been ever so right, but truth and righteousness do not always prevail in this world of ours. Indeed, they don't. The Bible itself, that otherwise optimistic book, lets this grand secret out once and only once in the story of Job. The happy ending in that book will deceive no realistic observer. It was added to the story, as it is added to modern plays and novels, for the edification and comfort of the audience. The true story of Job was without it, as was the true story of many a brave man, as was the true story of that great pope who on his deathbed came out with the confession: Dulci justitiam et odi iniquitatem, propter rea, morier, in exilio. 1. A confession which went in the very teeth of his own. Virtue-rewarding creed with its happy-go-lucky trust in the moral order of the universe. Nietzsche may have been right, therefore, he may be unsuccessful. I, myself, regard Nietzsche's views on art, religion, psychology, morality as extremely sound. I think they are proved both by history and by common experience. I even suspect that they could be confirmed by science, if only science would give up looking at the world through the colored spectacles of democratic prejudice. But then, it is so difficult to give up this democratic prejudice, for it is by no means simply a political opinion. Democracy as a political creed need terrify no one, for political creeds succeed each other like waves of the sea, whose thunder is loud and whose end is froth. But the driving power behind democracy is not a political one, it is religious. It is Christianity. A mighty religion still, a religion which has governed the world for 2,000 years, which has influenced all philosophies, all literatures, all laws, all customs up to our own day, till it has finally filtered into our hearts, our blood, our system, and become part and parcel of ourselves without our being aware of it. At the present moment, we are all instinctive Christians. Even if this Christian religion has been severely wounded by Nietzsche's criticism, and I believe this to be the case, I beg to suggest that a wounded lion may still have more strength than all the fussy political, rationalistic, agnostic, nonconformist, Nietzschean, and super-Nietzschean mice put together. It was all the braver, therefore, on Nietzsche's part to assail such a mighty enemy and to attack him exactly on the spot where attack was most needed if victory were to be won. Nietzsche clearly recognized that the canons of criticism had until now only been directed against the outer works of that stalwart fortress, at dogmatic, at supernatural, at ecclesiastical Christianity, and that no one had yet dared to aim right at the very heart of the creed, its morality, which, while the sham fighters were at work outside, was being enormously strengthened and consolidated from within. This morality, however, Nietzsche recognized as intimately connected with modern democracy and behind the rosebush of democracy with its flowery speeches and its fraternity and liberty blossoms. Nietzsche clearly saw the dragon of anarchy and dissolution lurking. It was the mortal fear of annihilation and ruin which gave Nietzsche the daring to fulminate against our religion with such imperishable dithyrambics. He was the first to mean the phrase, "Ecrasis el infame," which in Voltaire's mouth was only an epigrammatic exclamation. For Nietzsche's great forerunner on the continent, Wolfgang Goethe, who was also just as well aware how it would all end, was much too prudent a man to lay his innermost heart bare to his enemies. He, the grand old hypocrite of Weimar, gauged the power of the contrary current correctly and wisely left the open combat against Christianity and democracy to his great colleague, to that man of tragic wit, to Heinrich Heine. And there were others on the continent, very few to be sure, and no politician or man of science or woman among them, others who saw the drift of modern ideas, all of them poets. For poets are prophets, their sensitive organization feels the fall of the glass first, while their pluck and their pride, their duty and their desire to face the storm, drive them into the very thick of it. The German poet Hebel, the French novelist Stendhal were amongst them. A new Matthew Arnold, the object of my wish for this country, would perhaps like to include another poet, the Frenchman Alfred de Vigny, in whose journal are to be found those awe-inspiring words against democracy. Alas, it is thou, democracy, that art the desert. It is thou who hast shrouded and bleached everything beneath thy monticles of sand. Thy tedious flatness has covered everything and leveled all. Forever and ever, the valley and the hill supplant each other, and only from time to time a man of courage is seen. He rises like a sand whirl, makes his 10 paces towards the sun, and then falls like powder to the ground, and then nothing more is seen save the eternal plain of endless sand. Goethe and Hebel, Stendhal and Heinrich Heine, Alfred de Vigny and Friedrich Nietzsche all made their 10 steps towards the sun and are now sleeping peacefully beneath the dry sands of Christian democracy. Their works are read, to be sure, but alas, how few understand their meaning. I see this and I shudder. And I remember another moment in my life, a moment of perturbation too, a moment in which an idea overcame me which has been haunting me ever since. I was on a visit to Mrs. Förster Nietzsche in her villa high up amongst the hills of Weimar, waiting in the drawing room for my hostess to enter. It was the first time that I had stood upon the holy ground where Friedrich Nietzsche gave up his heroic soul, and I was naturally impressed. My eyes wandered reverently around the scene, and I suddenly noticed some handwriting on the wall. The handwriting consisted of a powerful, letter N which the ingenious builder had engraved profusely upon the oak panels of the room. The N, of course, reminded me of another big. N connected with another big name, the N which used to be engraved, together with the imperial crown and eagle upon the plate and regalia of Napoleon Bonaparte. There was another victim of democracy, the man who, elevated by its revolutionary wave, tried to stifle and subdue. The anarchical flood was swallowed up as ignominiously as its other, implacable opponent, the plucky parson's son of the vicarage of Wrekin, the mighty sword in the beginning and the mighty pen at the end of. The last century were alike impotent against fate. No doubt I saw, in that moment, as though lit up by a flashlight, the fate of Europe clearly before my eyes. A fate, an iron fate. A fate unavoidable, for a continent that will have no more guides, no more great men. A fate unavoidable for an age that spills its best blood with the carelessness of ignorance. A fate unavoidable for a people that is, driven by its very religion to disobedience and anarchy. And I thought. My own race, which has seen so many fates, so many ages, so many empires decline, and there was I, the eternal Jew, witnessing another catastrophe. And I shuddered, and when my hostess entered, I had not yet recovered my breath. Gruesome, isn't it? But what if it should not come true? There are no more prophets today, says the Talmud scornfully. Well, unlike my ancestor Jonah, who became melancholic when his announcement of the downfall of Nineveh was not fulfilled, I beg to say that I, contrary, shall be extremely delighted to have proved a false prophet, but I shall keep my umbrella all the same, Oscar Levy, 54 Russell Square, London, WC1. I have loved justice and I have hated iniquity, therefore I die in exile. Contents, introduction, chapter I, Nietzsche's life, chapter II, Nietzsche the amoralist, chapter III, Nietzsche the moralist, chapter IV, Nietzsche the evolutionist, chapter V, Nietzsche the sociologist, summary and conclusion. Books useful to the student of Nietzsche, abbreviations used in referring to Nietzsche's works, D. D equals dawn of day, Z equals thus spake Zarathustra, G. E equals beyond good and evil, G. M equals the genealogy of morals, APH equals aphorism, chapter I, life and works. Holy be thy name to all coming generations. In the name of all thy friends, I thy pupil, cry out our warmest thanks to thee for thy great life. Thou wast one of the noblest and purest men that ever trod this earth. And although this is known to both friend and foe, I do not deem it superfluous to utter this testimony aloud at thy tomb. For we know the world, we know the fate of Spinoza. Around Nietzsche's memory, too, posterity may cast shadows, and therefore I close with the words, peace to thy ashes. 1. This view, expressed by Peter Gast, Nietzsche's staunchest friend and disciple, at his master's graveside in August 1900, may be regarded as typical of the Nietzsche enthusiast's attitude towards his master. On the other hand, we have the assurance of Nietzsche's opponents and enemies that nothing could have been more utterly disastrous to modern society, more pernicious, dangerous, and ridiculous than Nietzsche's life work. At the present day, Nietzsche is so potent a force, and his influence is increasing with such rapidity that, whatever our calling in life may be, it behoves us to know precisely what he stands for, and to which of the opinions above given we should subscribe. As a matter of fact, the inquirer into the life and works of this interesting man will find that he has well nigh as many by names as he has readers, and not the least of our difficulties in speaking about him will be to give him a fitting title, descriptive of his mission and the way in which he understood it. Some deny his right to the title philosopher. Others declare him to be a mere anarchist, and a large number regard all his later works as no more than a shallow though brilliant reversal of every accepted doctrine on earth. In order to be able to provoke so much diversity of opinion, a man must be not only versatile but forcible. Nietzsche was both. There is scarcely a subject in the whole range of philosophical thought which he does not attack and blow up, and he hurls forth his hard, polished missiles in a manner so destructive and at the same time with such accuracy of aim that it is no wonder a chorus of ill-used strongholds of traditional thought now cry out against him as a disturber and annihilator of their peace. Yet through all the dust, smoke, and noise of his implacable warfare, there are both a method and a mission to be discerned, a method and a mission in the pursuit of which Nietzsche is really as unswerving as he seems capricious. Throughout his life and all his many recantations and revulsions of feeling, he remained faithful to one purpose and to one aim, the elevation of the type man. However bewildered we may become beneath the hail of his epigrams, treating of every momentous question that has ever agitated the human mind, we still can trace this broad principle, running through all his works, his desire to elevate man and to make him more worthy of humanity's great past, even in his attack on English psychologists, naturalists, and philosophers in The Genealogy of Morals. What are his charges against them? He says they debase man, voluntarily or involuntarily, by seeking the really operative, really imperative, and decisive factor in history. Precisely where the intellectual pride of man would least wish to find it, i.e. in vis inertiae, in some blind and accidental mechanism of ideas in automatic and purely passive adaptation and modification, in the compulsory action of adjustment to environment. Again, in his attack on the evolutionist's so-called struggle for existence, of which I shall speak more exhaustively later, it is the suggestion that life, mere existence in itself, is worthy of being. An aim at all that he deprecates so profoundly. And once more it is, with the view of elevating man and his aspirations, that he levels the attack. Whatever we may think of his methods, therefore, at least his aim was sufficiently lofty and honorable, and we must bear in mind that he never shirked the duties which, rightly or wrongly, he imagined would help him to achieve it. What was Nietzsche? If we accept his own definition of the philosopher's task on earth, we must place him in the front rank of philosophers, for according to him, the creation of new values, new principles, new standards is the philosopher's sole raison d'etre, and this he certainly accomplished. If, on the other hand, with all the school philosophers, we ask him to show us his system, we shall most surely be disappointed. In this respect, therefore, we may perhaps need to modify our opinion of him. Be that as it may, it is safe to maintain that he was a poet of no mean order, not a mere versifier or rhapsodist, but a poet in the old Greek sense of the word, i.e., a maker. In our time, such men are so rare that we are apt to question whether they exist at all, for poetasters have destroyed our faith in them. Goethe was perhaps the last example of the type in modern Europe, and although we may recall the scientific achievements of men like Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and Galileo, we are not sufficiently ready to associate their divining an intuitive power in the department of science with their purely artistic and poetic achievements, despite the fact that the two are really inseparable. Knowing the high authority with which poets of this order are wont to sneak, it might be supposed that we should approach Nietzsche's innovations in the realm of science with some respect, not in spite of, but precisely owing to, his great poetic genius. Unfortunately today, this no longer follows. Too thoroughly have we divorced science from emotion and feeling, very wrongly, as even Herbert Spencer and Buckle both declared, and now, wherever we see emotion or a suggestion of passion, we are too apt to purse our lips and stand on our guard. When we consider that Nietzsche was ultimately to prove the bitterest enemy of Christianity and the severest critic of the ecclesiastic, his antecedents seem, to say the least, remarkable. His father, Carl Ludwig Nietzsche, born in 1813, was a clergyman of the German Protestant Church. His grandfather had also taken orders, whilst his grandmother, on his father's side, was descended from a long line of parsons. Nor do things change very much when we turn to his mother's family, for his maternal grandfather, Ohler, was also a clergyman, and according to Nietzsche's sister, he appears to have been a very sound, though broad, theologian. Yet perhaps it is we who are wrong in seeing anything strange in the fact that a man with such orthodox antecedents should have developed into a prophet and reformer of Nietzsche's stamp. For we should remember that only a long tradition of discipline and strict conventionality, lasting over a number of generations, is able to rear that willpower and determination which, as the lives of most great men have shown, are the first conditions of all epoch-making movements, started by single individuals. Friedrich Nietzsche was born at Röcken near Lützen in the Prussian province of Saxony on the 15th of October 1844. From his earliest childhood onwards, the boy seems to have been robust and active and does not appear to have suffered from any of the ordinary ailments of infancy. In the biography written by his sister, much stress is laid upon this fact, while the sometimes exceptional health enjoyed by his parents and ancestors is duly emphasized by the anxious biographer, Elizabeth Nietzsche, born in July 1846. The biographer in question is perfectly justified in establishing these facts with care, for we know that our poet-philosopher died insane, and many have sought to show that his insanity was hereditary and could be traced throughout his works. Nietzsche's father died in 1849, and in the following year the family removed to Naumburg. There the boy received his early schooling, first at a preparatory school and subsequently at the gymnasium, the grammar school of the town. As a lad, it is said that he was fond of military games and of sitting alone, and it appears that he would recline for hours at his grandmother Nietzsche's feet, listening to her reminiscences of the great Napoleon. Towards the end of 1858, Mrs. Nietzsche was offered a scholarship for her son for a term of 6 years in the Landschule Forda, so famous for the scholars it produced. At Forda, where the discipline was very severe, the boy followed the regular school course and worked with great industry. His sister tells us that during this period he distinguished himself, most in his private studies and artistic efforts, though even in the ordinary work of the school he was decidedly above the average. It was here, too, that he first became acquainted with Wagner's compositions, and a word ought now perhaps to be said in regard to his musical studies. Music, we know, played anything but a minor role in his later life, as his three important essays, Richard Wagner in Bayreuth, The Case of Wagner, and Nietzsche contra Wagner, are with us to prove. I fear, however, that it will be impossible to go very deeply into this question here, save at the cost of other still more important matters, which have a prior claim to our attention. Let it then suffice to say that, as a boy, Nietzsche's talent had already become so noticeable that for some time the question which agitated the elders in his circle of relatives and friends, among whom were some competent judges, was whether he should not give up all else in order to develop his great gift. In the end, however, it was decided that he should become a scholar, and although he never entirely gave up composing and playing the piano, music never attained to anything beyond the dignity of a serious hobby in his life. In saying this, I naturally exclude his critical writings on the subject, which are at once valuable and important. Nietzsche's 6 years at Forda were responsible for a large number of his subsequent ideas. When we hear him laying particular stress upon the value of rigorous training free from all sentimentality, when we read his views concerning austerity and the importance of law, order, and discipline, we must bear in mind that he is speaking with an actual knowledge of these things and with profound experience of their worth. The excellence of his philological work may also be ascribed to the very sound training he received at Forda and the Latin essay which he wrote on an original subject. Theognis, the great aristocratic poet of Megara for the leaving examination, laid the foundation of all his subsequent opinions on morality. Nietzsche left Forda in September 1864 and entered the University of Bonn, where he studied philology and theology. The latter he abandoned 6 months later, however, and in the autumn of 1865 he left Bonn for Leipzig, whither his famous teacher Ritschl had preceded him. Between 1865 and 1867, his work at Leipzig proved of the utmost importance to his career. Hellenism, Schopenhauer, and Wagner now entered into his life and became paramount influences with him, and each in its way determined what his ultimate mission was to be. Hellenism drew him ever more strongly to philology and to the problem of culture in general. Schopenhauer directed him to philosophy, and Wagner taught him his first steps in a subject which was to be the actual leitmotif of his teaching. I refer to the question of art. His work during these 2 years, arduous though it was, in no way affected his health, and despite his short sight, he tells us that he was then able to endure the greatest strain without the smallest trouble. Being of a robust and energetic nature, however, he was anxious to discover some means of employing his bodily strength, and it was for this reason that, regardless of the interruption in his work, he was enthusiastic at the thought of becoming a soldier. In the autumn of 1867, he entered the 4th Regiment of Field Artillery, and it is said that he performed his duties to the complete satisfaction of his superiors. But alas, this lasted but a short time, for, as the result of an unfortunate fall from a restive horse, he was compelled to leave the colors before he had completed his term of service. In October 1868, after a serious illness, the student returned to his work at Leipzig, and now that event took place which was perhaps the most triumphant and most decisive in his career. It was Nietzsche's ambition to get his doctor's degree as soon as possible and then to travel. Meanwhile, however, others were busy determining what he should do. Some philological essays which he had written in his student days, and which, owing to their excellence, had been published by the Rheinisches Museum, had attracted the attention of the Educational Board of Bale. One of the board communicated with Ritschl concerning Nietzsche, and the reply the learned scholar sent was so favorable that the University of Bale immediately offered Ritschl's favorite pupil their professorship of classical philology. This was an exceptional honor, and to crown it, the University of Leipzig quickly granted Nietzsche his doctor's degree without further examination. Truly a remarkable occurrence in straight-laced and formal Germany, his first years at Bale are chiefly associated in our minds with his inaugural address, Homer and Classical Philology, with his action in regard to the Franco-German War, and with his lectures on the future of our educational institutions. I can do no more than refer to these here, but as regards the war, it is necessary to go into further detail. In July 1870, hostilities opened between France and Prussia. Now, although Nietzsche had been forced to become a naturalized Swiss subject in order to accept his appointment at Bale, he was loth to remain inactive while his own countrymen fought for the honor of Germany. He could not, however, fight for the Germans without compromising Switzerland's neutrality. He therefore went as a hospital attendant, and in this capacity, after obtaining the necessary leave, he followed his former compatriots to the war. According to Elizabeth Nietzsche, it was this act of devotion which was the cause of all her brother's subsequent ill health. In Ars Sermocel, while tending the sick and wounded, Nietzsche contracted dysentery from those in his charge. With his constitution undermined by the exertions of the campaign, he fell very seriously ill and had to be relieved of his duties. Long before he was strong enough to do so, however, he resumed his work at Bale, and now began that second phase of his life during which he never once recovered the health he had enjoyed before the war. In January 1872, Nietzsche published his first book, The Birth of Tragedy. It is really but a portion of a much larger work on Hellenism, which he had always had in view from his earliest student days, and it may be said to have been prepared in two preliminary lectures delivered at Bale under the title of The Greek Musical Drama and Socrates and Tragedy. The work was received with enthusiasm by Wagnerians, but among Nietzsche's philological friends, it succeeded in rousing little more than doubt and suspicion. It was a sign that the young professor was beginning to ascribe too much importance to art in its influence upon the world, and this the dry men of science could not tolerate. Between 1873 and 1876, Nietzsche, while still at Bale, published four more essays which for matter and form proved to be among the most startling productions that Germany had read since Schopenhauer's prime. Their author called these essays thoughts out of season, and his aim in writing them was undoubtedly the regeneration of German culture. The first was an attack on German Philistinism in the person of David Strauss, the famous theologian of Tübingen, whom Nietzsche dubbed the Philistine of culture, and was calculated to check the extreme smugness which had suddenly invaded all departments of thought and activity in Germany as the result of the recent military triumph. The second, The Use and Abuse of History, was a protest against excessive indulgence in the historical sense or the love of looking backwards, which threatened to paralyze the intelligence of Germany in those days. In it, Nietzsche tries to show how history is for the few and not for the many, and points out how rare are those who have the strength to endure the lesson of experience. In the third, Schopenhauer as Educator, Nietzsche pits his great teacher against all other dry-as-dust philosophers who make for stagnation in philosophy. The fourth, Richard Wagner in Bayreuth, contains Nietzsche's last word of praise as a friend of the great German musician. In it, we already see signs of his revulsion of feeling, but on the whole, it is a panegyric written with love and conviction. The fourth, Richard Wagner in Bayreuth, contains Nietzsche's last word of praise as a friend of the great German musician. In it, we already see signs of his revulsion of feeling, but on the whole, it is a panegyric written with love and conviction. The only one of the four thoughts out of season which created much comment was the first, concerning David Strauss, and this gave rise to a loud outcry against the daring young philologist. Nietzsche had been very unwell throughout this period. Dyspepsia and headaches brought on partly by overwork racked him incessantly, and in addition, he was getting ever nearer and nearer to a final and irrevocable breach with the greatest friend of his life, Richard Wagner. After obtaining leave from the authorities, he went to Sorrento, where, in the autumn of 1876, he began work on his next important book, Human, All Too Human, the book which was to part him forever from Wagner. In February 1878, the first volume was ready for the printer and was published almost simultaneously with Wagner's Parsifal, which work, as is well known, was the death blow to Nietzsche's faith in his former idol. In Human, All Too Human, Nietzsche as a philosopher is not yet standing on his own legs, as it were. He is only just beginning to feel his way and is still deeply immersed in the thought of other men, more particularly that of the English positivists, as a work of transition. However, Human All Too Human is exceedingly interesting, as are also its sequels, Miscellaneous Opinions and Apophthegms, 1879, and The Wanderer and His Shadow, 1880. But in none of these, as the author himself admits, is there to be found that certainty of aim and treatment which characterized his later writings. In 1879, owing to ill health, Nietzsche was compelled to resign his professorship at the University of Bale, and the spring of that year saw him an independent man with an annual pension of 3,000 francs, generously granted to him by the Board of Management on the acceptance of his resignation. With this pension and a small private income, derived from a capital of about 1,400 pounds, he was not destitute, though by no means affluent, and when we remember that he was obliged to defray the expenses of publication in the case of almost every one of his books, we may form some idea of his actual resources. From this time forward, Nietzsche's life was spent in traveling and writing. Venice, Marienbad, Zurich, St. Moritz in the Oberengadin, Sils Maria, Tottenberg in Thuringia, Genoa, etc., etc., were among the places at which he stayed, according to the season, and during the year 1880 his health materially improved. In January 1881 he had completed the manuscript of The Dawn of Day, and is said to have been well satisfied with his condition. In The Dawn of Day, Nietzsche for the first time begins to reveal his real personality. This book is literally the dawn of his great life work, and in it we find him grappling with all the problems which he was subsequently to tackle with such a masterly and courageous hand. It appeared in July 1881 and met with but a poor reception. Indeed, after the publication of the last of the Thoughts Out of Season, Nietzsche appears to have created very little stir among his countrymen, a fact which, though it greatly depressed him, only made him redouble his energies. In September 1882, The Joyful Wisdom was published, a book written during one of the happiest periods of his life. It is a veritable fanfare of trumpets announcing the triumphal entry of its distinguished follower, Zarathustra. With it, Nietzsche's final philosophical views are already making headway, and it is full of the love of life and energy which permeates the grand philosophical poem which was to come after it. Disappointed by the meager success of his works and hurt by the attitude of various friends, Nietzsche now retired into loneliness, and settling down on the beautiful bay of Rapallo, began work on that wonderful moral, psychological, and critical rhapsody, Thus Spake Zarathustra, which was to prove the greatest of his creations. During the years 1883-84, the three first parts of this work were published, and though each part was issued separately and met with the same cold reception which had been given to his other works of recent years, Nietzsche never once lost heart or wavered in his resolve. It required, however, all the sublime inspirations which we find expressed in that wonderful book For All and None to enable a man to stand firmly and absolutely alone amid all the hardships and reverses that beset our anchorite poet throughout this period. It was about this time that Nietzsche began to take chloral in the hope of overcoming his insomnia. It was now, too, that his sister, the only relative for whom, despite some misunderstandings, he had a real affection, became engaged to a man with whom he was utterly out of sympathy, and all the while negotiations into which Nietzsche had entered with the Leipzig University for the purpose of securing another professorial chair were becoming ever more hopeless. In the course of this exposition, I shall have to treat of the doctrines enunciated in Thus Spake Zarathustra. Indeed, seeing that this work contains all Nietzsche's thought in a poetical form, it would be quite impossible to discuss any single tenet of his philosophy without in some way referring to the book in question. I cannot therefore say much about it at present, save that it is generally admitted to be Nietzsche's opus magnum. Besides the philosophical views expounded in the four parts of which it consists, the value of its autobiographical passages is enormous. In it we find the history of his most intimate experiences, friendships, feuds, disappointments, triumphs, and the like, and the whole is written in a style so magnetic and poetical that, as a specimen of Bell's letters alone, entirely apart from the questions it treats, the work cannot and ought not to be overlooked. Although there is now scarcely a European language into which Zarathustra has not been translated, although the fame of the work at present is almost universal, the reception it met with at the time of its publication was so unsatisfactory and misunderstanding, relative to its teaching became so general that within a year of the issue of its first part, Nietzsche was already beginning to see the necessity of bringing his doctrines before the public in a more definite and unmistakable form. During the years that followed, that is, to say, between 1883 and 1886, this plan was matured, and between 1886 and 1889, the year of our author's final breakdown, three important books were published which may be regarded as prose sequels to the poem, Zarathustra. These books are Beyond Good and Evil, 1886, The Genealogy of Morals, 1887, and The Twilight of the Idols, 1889, while the posthumous works, The Will to Power, 1901, and the little volume Antichrist, published in 1895 when its author was lying hopelessly ill at Naumburg, also belong to the period in which Nietzsche wished to make his Zarathustra clear and comprehensible to his fellows. In the ensuing chapters, it will be my endeavor to state briefly all that is vital in the works just referred to. What remains to be related of Nietzsche's life is sad enough and is almost common knowledge. When his sister Elizabeth married Dr. Förster and went to Paraguay with her spouse, Nietzsche was practically without a friend, and had it not been for Peter Gast's devotion and help, he would probably have succumbed to his constitutional and mental troubles much sooner than he actually did, before his last breakdown. In Turin, in January 1889, the only real encouragement he is ever known to have received in regard to his philosophical works came to him from Copenhagen and Paris. In the latter city, it was Taine who committed himself by praising Nietzsche, and in the former, it was Dr. George Brands, a clever and learned professor who delivered a series of lectures on the new message of the German philosopher. The news of Brand's success in Copenhagen in 1888 greatly brightened Nietzsche's last year of authorship, and he corresponded with the Danish professor until the end. It has been rightly observed that these lectures were the dawn of Nietzscheism in Europe. As the result of overwork, excessive indulgence in drugs, and a host of disappointments and anxieties, Nietzsche's great mind at last collapsed on the 2nd or 3rd of January 1889, never again to recover. The last words he wrote, which were subsequently found on a slip of paper in his study, throw more light upon the tragedy of his breakdown than all the learned medical treatises that have been written about his case. "I am taking narcotic after narcotic," he said, "in order to drown my anguish, but still I cannot sleep. Today I will certainly take such a quantity as will drive me out of my mind." From that time to the day of his death, 25th August 1900, he lingered a helpless and unconscious invalid, first in the care of his aged mother, and ultimately, when Elizabeth returned a widow from Paraguay, as his sister's beloved charge, for an opinion of Nietzsche during his last phase, "I cannot do better than quote Professor Henry Lichtenberger of Nancy, who saw the invalid in 1898, and with this sympathetic Frenchman's valuable observations, I shall draw this chapter to a close. In the gradual wane of this enthusiastic lover of life, of this apologist of energy, of this prophet of Superman, there is something inexpressibly sad, inexpressibly beautiful and peaceful. His brow is still magnificent, his eyes, the light of which seems to be directed inwards, have an expression which is indefinably and profoundly moving. What is going on within his soul? Nobody can say. It is just possible that he may have preserved a dim recollection of his life as a thinker and a poet. 1. Does Leben Friedrich Nietzsche's by Frau Förster Nietzsche, Chapter II, Nietzsche the Amoralist. From a casual study of Nietzsche's life, it might be gathered that he had little time for private meditation or for any lonely brooding over problems foreign to his school and university studies. Indeed, from the very moment when it was decided that he should become a scholar, to the day when the University of Leipzig granted him his doctor's degree without examination, his existence seems to have been so wholly occupied by strenuous application to the duties which his aspirations imposed upon him that, even if he had had the will to do so, it would seem that he could not have had the leisure to become engaged in any serious thought outside his regular work. Nevertheless, if we inquire into the matter more deeply, we find to our astonishment that, during the whole of that arduous period, from his 13th to this 24th year, his imagination did not once cease from playing around problems of the highest import, quite unrelated to his school and university subjects. In the introduction to The Genealogy of Morals, he writes as follows: While but a boy of 13, the problem of the origin of evil haunted me. To it I dedicated in an age when we have in heart half play, half God, my first literary child play, my first philosophical composition, and as regards my solution of the problem, therein, well, I gave, as is but fair, God the honor and made him. Father of evil. 1. And then he continues. A little historical and philological schooling together with an inborn and delicate sense regarding psychological questions changed my problem in a very short time into that other one. Under what circumstances and conditions did man invent the valuations good and evil, and what is their own specific value? This problem, as stated here, seems stupendous enough. In fact, it would be difficult in the whole realm of human thought to discover a question of greater moment and intricacy, and yet we shall see that Nietzsche was just as much born to attack and solve it as Cardinal Newman seems, from the Apologia pro Vita Sua, to have been born to the Roman Catholic Church. If we reflect a moment, we find that good and evil are certainly words that exercise a tremendous power in the world. To attach the word good to anything or deed is to give it the hallmark of desirability. On the other hand, to attach the word evil to it is tantamount to proscribing it from existence. Even in the Old English proverb, give a dog a bad name and hang him, we have a suggestion of the enormous force which has been compressed into the two monosyllables, good and bad. And before we seriously take up the problem, it were well to ponder a while over the really profound significance of these two words. Nietzsche, as we have already observed, was never in any doubt as to their importance. His life passion was the desire to solve the meaning, the origin, and the intrinsic value of the two terms, and he did not rest until he had achieved his end. Let us now examine what morality, what good and evil, means to almost everybody today. In the minds of nearly all those people who are neither students nor actual teachers of philosophy, there is a superstition that good is a perfectly definite and absolute value, and that evil is known unto all. Few seem to doubt that the meaning of these words has been fixed once and forever. The ordinary European lives, reads, and sleeps year in, year out under the delusion that all is quite clear in regard to right and wrong. Such a person is, of course, somewhat abashed when you tell him that a certain people in the East practice infanticide and call it good, or that a certain people in the West always separate at meals and eat apart and call this good. He usually gets over the difficulty, however, by saying that they know no better, and when at last he is hard-pressed and is bound to admit that views of good and bad, sometimes the reverse of his own, actually do preserve and unite people in strange lands, he takes refuge in the hope that all differences may one day be broken down and that the problem will thus be solved. No such facile shelving of the question, however, could satisfy Nietzsche. From the very outset, he freed himself from all national and even racial prejudices and could see no particular reason why the kind of morality now prevailing in Europe or countries like Europe must necessarily and ultimately overcome and supplant all others. He therefore attacked the question with a perfectly open mind and asked himself whether he quite understood the part the terms good and evil have played in human history. Is morality its justification in our midst and its mode of action comprehended at all? He replies to this question so daringly and so uprightly that at first his clearness may only bewilder us. These terms good and evil, he tells us, are merely a means to the acquisition of power. And indeed, in the very resistance we offer when he attempts to criticize our notions of morality, we tacitly acknowledge that in this morality our strength does actually reside. No greater power on earth was found by Zarathustra than good and evil. 2. No people could live without first valuing. If a people will maintain itself, however, it must not value as its neighbor valueth. 3. In the last sentence, we have seized Nietzsche's clue to the whole question. If you would maintain yourself, you cannot and must not value as your neighbor values. Good and evil, then, are not permanent, absolute values. They are transient, relative values serving an end, which can be explained in terms of biology and anthropology. But now let us halt a moment, for the sake of clearness, and let us inquire precisely how Nietzsche himself was led to this conclusion. In the summer of 1864, when he was in his 20th year, he was given some homework to do which he was expected to have ready by the end of the holidays. It was to consist of a Latin thesis upon some optional subject, and he chose Theognis, the aristocratic poet of Megara. While preparing the work, he was struck with the author's use of the words good and bad as synonymous with aristocratic and plebeian, and it was this valuable hint which first set him on the right track. Theognis and his friends, being desirous of making their power prevail, were naturally compelled to regard any force which assailed that power as bad, bad, in the sense of dangerous to their order of power. And thus it came to pass that Theognis, as an aristocrat in the heat of a struggle between an oligarchy and a democracy, spoke of the democratic values as bad and of those of his own party as good. The writing of this essay had other consequences which I shall only be able to refer to in the next chapter, but at present let it suffice to say that, in recognizing the arbitrary use made by Theognis of the epithets good and bad in designating the oligarchy and the democracy, respectively, Nietzsche was first induced to look upon morality merely as a weapon in the struggle for power, and he thus freed himself from all the usual bias which belongs to the absolutist standpoint. Hence, his claim to the surname amoralist, and his use of the phrase beyond good and evil as the title of one of his greatest works. Let us, however, remember that although Nietzsche did undoubtedly take up a position beyond good and evil in order to free himself temporarily from the gyves of all tradition, still this attitude was no more than a momentary one, and he ultimately became as rigid a moralist as the most exacting could desire. It was a new morality, however, or perhaps a forgotten one, which he ultimately preached, and with the view of preparing the ground for it, he was in a measure obliged to destroy old idols. He who hath to be a creator in good and evil, says Zarathustra, verily he hath first to be a destroyer and to break values to pieces. For, assuming the position of the relativist, then Nietzsche observed that all morality, all use of the words good and evil, is only an artifice for acquiring power. Turning to the animal kingdom, he went in search of support for his views, and very soon discovered that, in biology at least, no fact was at variance with his general hypothesis. In nature, every species of organic being behaves as if its kind alone ought ultimately to prevail on earth, and whether it try to effect this end by open aggression or cowardly dissimulation, the motive in both cases is the same. The lion's good is the antelope's evil. If the antelope believed the lion's good to be its good, it would go and present itself without further ado before the lion's jaws. If the lion believed the antelope's good to be its good, it would adopt vegetarianism forthwith and eschew its carnivorous habits for the rest of its days. Again, no parasite could share the notions of good and evil entertained by its victim, neither could the victims share the notions of good and evil entertained by the parasite. Everywhere, then, those modes of conduct are adopted and perpetuated by a species which most conduce to the prevalence and extension of their particular kind, and that species which fails to discover the class of conduct best calculated to preserve and strengthen it gets overcome in the war of conduct which constitutes the incessant struggle for power. Now, applying the knowledge to man, what did Nietzsche find? He found there was also a war being waged between the different modes of conduct which now prevail among men, and that what one man sets up as good is called evil by another, and vice versa. But of this he soon became convinced, that whenever and wherever good and evil had been set up as absolute values, they had been thus elevated to power with the view of preserving and multiplying one specific type of man. All moralities, therefore, were but so many trades union banners flying above the heads of different classes of men, woven and upheld by them for their own needs and aspirations. So far, so good. But then, if that were so, the character of a morality must be determined by the class of men among whom it came into being. We shall see that Nietzsche did not hesitate to accept this conclusion, and that if for a moment he declared, "No one knoweth yet what is good and what is evil," the next minute he was asking himself this searching question: is our morality, that is to say, the particular table of values which is gradually modifying us, compatible with an ideal worthy of man's inheritance and past? If Nietzsche has been called dangerous, pernicious, and immoral, it is because people have deliberately overlooked this last question of his. No thinker who states and honestly sets out to answer this question, as Nietzsche did, deserves to be slandered, as he has been slandered, by prejudiced and interested people intent on misunderstanding only, in order that they may fling mud more freely. Nietzsche cast his critical eye very seriously around him, and the sight of the modern world led him to ask these admittedly pertinent questions: is that which we have for centuries held for good and evil really good and evil? Does our table of ethical principles seem to be favoring the multiplication of a desirable type? In answering these two inquiries, Nietzsche unfortunately stormed the most formidable strongholds of modern society, Christianity, and democracy, and perhaps this accounts for the fact that his fight was so uneven and so hopeless. The strength of modern Europe, if indeed there be any strength in her, lies precisely on the side of Christianity and democracy, the grandmother and the mother of what is called progress, modernity. And in assailing these, Nietzsche must have known that he was engaging in a hand-to-hand struggle with stony-hearted adversaries, unaccustomed to giving quarter and unscrupulous in their methods. Nietzsche clearly saw that if all moral codes are but weapons, protecting and helping to universalize distinct species of men, then the Christian religion with its ethical principles could be no exception to the rule. It must have been created at some time and in some place by one who had the interests of a certain type of man at heart and who desired to make that type paramount. Now, if that were really so, the next question that occurred to Nietzsche's mercilessly logical mind was this: is the Christian religion, with its morality, tending to preserve and multiply a desirable type of man? To this last question, Nietzsche replies most emphatically, no. But before going into the reasons of this flat negative, let us first pause to consider the age and the circumstances in which our author wrote and thought, long before Nietzsche had reached his prime. David Strauss had published his Life of Jesus in 1863, when Nietzsche was still in his teens. Renan published his Vita de Jesus, and in the meantime, Charles Darwin had given his Origin of Species to the world. These books had been read by a Europe that had already studied Hume and Lamarck, Kant, and Schopenhauer, and in all directions a fine ear could not help hearing the falling timbers of Christian dogma. In the midst of this general work of destruction, it was almost impossible for Nietzsche to remain unmoved or indifferent, and very soon he found that he too was drawn into the general stream of European thought, but only to prove how completely he was independent of it and in every way superior to it. He contemplated the work of the destroyers for some time with amused interest, and then it suddenly occurred to him to inquire whether these zealous and well-meaning housebreakers were really doing any lasting good, or whether all their efforts were not perhaps a little misguided. True, they were pulling the embellishments from the walls and were casting the most cherished idols of the Christian faith into the dust. But the walls themselves, the actual design of the edifice, remained untouched and as strong as ever. A few broken stones, a few complaints from the priestly archaeologists who wished to preserve them, and then all the noise subsided. Europe remained as it was before. That is to say, still in possession of a stronghold of Christianity, merely divested of its superfluous ornament. Nietzsche soon perceived that, in spite of all the rubbish and refuse which such people as Kant, Schopenhauer, Strauss, Renan, and others had made of Christian dogma, the essential core of Christianity, the vital organ of its body, its morality, had so far remained absolutely intact. Nay, he saw that it was actually being plastered up and restored by scholars and men of science who vowed that they could proffer reasonable, rationalistic, and logical grounds in support of it, just as Christian dogma and metaphysics had been rationalized and philosophically proved by the scholars of the Middle Ages and even as late as Leibniz. So now Christian morality was being presented in a purely philosophical garb by the intellects of Europe. Having relinquished the dogma as no longer tenable, all scholars and men of science were trying with redoubled vigor to bolster up Christian ethics with elaborate textbooks and learned treatises. There were some who accepted it all as if it were innate in human nature and attributed it to a moral sense. There were others, good-natured biologists, who were likewise desirous of leaving it whole and who declared with conviction that it was the natural outcome of the feelings of pleasure and pain. And there were yet others who assumed that it must have been evolved quite automatically out of expediency and non-expediency. Not one of these would-be rationalists, however, halted at the Christian terms good and bad themselves in order to ask himself whether, like all the other notions of good and evil prevailing elsewhere under the shelter of other religions, these, the Christian notions, might not have been invented at some particular time by a certain kind of man, simply with the view of preserving and universalizing his specific type. Breathless from their efforts at getting rid of the dogma, they did not dream that perhaps the most important part of the work still remained to be done. Nietzsche went to the very foundation of the Christian edifice. He pointed to its morality and said, "If we are going to measure the value of this religion, let us cease our petty quarrels concerning the truth or falsehood of such stories as the loss of the Gadarene swine, or the miracle of the loaves and fishes, and let us throw the whole of Christian morality into the scales and appraise its precise worth as a system of ethics. Nietzsche would have scorned to quarrel with the church, as Huxley did, for much more important issues were at stake. The worth of a religion is measured by its morality, because by its morality it molds and rears men and reveals the type of man who ultimately wishes to prevail by means of it. With the metaphysics and the dogma of Christianity in ruins all around him, therefore, Nietzsche took a step very far in advance of the rationalistic iconoclasts of his age. He attacked Christian morals and declared them to be, like all other morals, merely a weapon in the hands of a certain type of man with which that type struggled for power. But bold as this step was, it constituted but the first of a series, the next of which was to discover the type which had laid the foundations of the Christian ideal. If it could be proved that these Christian values had been created by a noble species with the object of perpetuating that species, then Christianity would come forth from the inquiry vindicated to the hilt and fill the damage done to its dogma, would not have deterred Nietzsche from standing by it and upholding it to his very last breath. Alas, things turned out somewhat differently, and Nietzsche was not by any means the least pained by the result. Pursuing the inquiry with his usual unflinching and uncompromising honesty, and avoiding no conclusion however unpleasant or fatal, Nietzsche, the scion of a profoundly religion's house, the lover of order and tradition with the blood of generations of earnest believers, in his veins, finally found himself compelled to renounce and even to condemn, root and branch, the faith which had been the strength and hope of his forebears, before turning to the next chapter, where I shall explain how he came to regard this step as inevitable. It should be said concerning Nietzsche's philosophy in general that it is essentially and through religious and almost prophetic in spirit. No careful reader of his works can doubt that Nietzsche was a deeply religious man. A glance at Thus Spake Zarathustra alone would convince any one of this, while in his constant references to religion throughout his works as a step to higher intellectuality, 5. As a means to invaluable contentedness, 6. As a measure of discipline, 7. As a powerful social factor, 8. A more substantial confirmation of the fact is to be found. It is well to bear in mind, however, throughout our study of Nietzsche, that he had a higher type always in view, that he was also well aware that this type could only be attained by the strict observance of a new morality, and that if he opposed other forms of morality, more particularly the Christian form, it was because he earnestly believed that they were rearing an undesirable and even despicable kind of man. Verily, men have made for themselves all their good and evil. Verily, they did not take it, they did not find it, it did not come down as a voice from heaven. 9. Behold the good and just. Whom do they hate most? Him who breaketh up their tables of values, the breaker, the lawbreaker. He, however, is the creator. 10. Verily, a muddy stream is man. One must be at least a sea to be able to absorb a muddy stream without becoming unclean. Behold, I teach you Superman. He is that sea. In him your great contempt can sink. 11. 1. See also DDAPH. 81-2-Z-P67-3-Z-P65-4-Z-P138-5-G-EP81-6-G-EP81-7-G-EP88-G-M-3rd-SA-APH-L59-Z-P67-10-Z-P20-11-Z-P8-Chapter II Nietzsche the Moralist, conceiving all forms of morality to be but weapons in the struggle. For power, Nietzsche concluded that every species of man must at some time or other have taken to moralizing, and must have called that good which its instincts approved, and that bad which its enemies' instincts approved. In Beyond Good and Evil, however, he tells us that after making a careful examination of the finer and coarser moralities which have hitherto prevailed or still prevail on earth, he found certain traits recurring so regularly together and so closely connected with one another that finally two primary types of morality revealed themselves to him. That is to say, after passing the known moralities of the world in review, he was able to classify them broadly into two types. He observed that throughout human history there had been a continual and implacable war between two kinds of men. It must have begun in the remotest ages, and it continues to this day. It is the war between the powerful and the impotent, the strong and the weak, the givers and the takers, the healthy and the sick, the happy and the wretched. The powerful formed their concept of good, and it was one which justified their strongest instincts. the impotent likewise acquired their view of the matter, which was often precisely the reverse of the former view. In this way, Nietzsche arrived at the following broad generalization, that all the moralities of the world could be placed under one of two heads, master morality or slave morality. In the first, the master morality, it is the oak which contends, I must reach the sun and spread broad brandies in so doing, this I call good, and the herd that I shelter may also call it good. In the second, the slave morality, it is the shrub which says, I also want to reach the sun, these broad branches of the oak, however, keep the sun from me, therefore the oak's instincts are bad. It is obvious that these two points of view exist and have existed everywhere on earth. Apart from national and racial distinctions, mankind does fall into the two broad classes of master and slave, or ruler and subject. We also know that each of these classes must have developed its moral code and must have tried to protect its conduct and life therewith. But what we did not know until Nietzsche pointed the fact out to us was, which morality is the more desirable and the more full of promise for the future, admitting that the master and the slave moralities are struggling for supremacy still, which of them ought we to promote with every means in our power? Which of them is going to make life more attractive, more justifiable, and more acceptable on earth? These are now questions of the utmost importance, because it is precisely now that pessimism, nihilism, and other desperate faiths are beginning to set their note of interrogation to human existence and to shake our belief even in the desirability of our own survival. It is now time for us to discover whence arises this contempt and horror of life, and to lay the blame for it either at the door of the master or of the slave morality. In order that we may understand how to set forth upon this inquiry, let us first form a mental image of the two codes as they must have been evolved by their originators. Nietzsche reminds us before we start, however, 1. That in most communities, the two moralities have become so confused and mingled in order to establish that compromise which is so dear to the hearts of the peaceful, that it would be almost a hopeless task to seek any society on earth in which they are now to be seen juxtaposed in sharp contrast. Be this as it may, in order to recognize the blood of each when we come across it, we have only to think of what must have occurred when the ruling caste and the ruled class took to moralizing. Taking the ruling caste first, it is clear that in their morality, all is good, which proceeds from strength, power, health, well-constitutedness, happiness, and awfulness for the motive force. Behind the people who evolved it was simply the will to discharge a plenitude, a superabundance of spiritual and physical wealth, a consciousness of high tension, of a treasure that would fain give and bestow. This is the mental attitude of the nobles. The antithesis, good and bad to this first class means the same as noble and despicable. Bad in the master morality must be applied to the coward, to all acts that spring from weakness, to the man with an eye, to the main chance, who would forsake everything in order to live. The creator of the master morality was he who, out of the very fullness of his soul, transfigured all he saw and heard and declared it better, greater, more beautiful than it appeared to the creator of the slave morality. Great artists, great legislators, and great warriors belong to the class that created master morality. Turning now to the second class, we must bear in mind that it is the product of a community in which the struggle for existence is the prime life motor. There, inasmuch as oppression, suffering, weariness, and servitude are the general rule, all will be regarded as good that tends to alleviate pain. Pity, the obliging hand, the warm heart, patience, industry, and humility, these are undoubtedly the virtues we shall here find elevated to the highest places because they are useful. Virtues, they make life endurable, they are helpful in the struggle for existence. To this class, all that proceeds from strength, superabundance of spiritual or bodily power or great health is looked upon with loathing and mistrust, while that which is awful is the worst and greatest evil. He is good who is amenable, kind, unselfish, meek, and submissive. That is why in all communities where slave morality is in the ascendant, a good fellow always suggests a man in possession of a fair modicum of foolishness and sentimentality. The creator of slave morality was one who, out of the poverty of his soul, transfigured all he saw and heard and declared it smaller, meaner, and less beautiful than it appeared to the creator of the master values. Great misanthropists, pessimists, demagogues, tasteless artists, nihilists, spiteful authors and dramatists, and resentful saints belong to the class that created slave morality. The first order of values are active, creative, Dionysiac. The second are passive, defensive, venomous, subterranean. To them belong adaptation, adjustment, and utilitarian relationship to environment. Now, seeing that mankind is undoubtedly molded by the nature of the values which prevail over it, it is manifestly of paramount importance to the philosopher to know which order of values conduces to rear the most desirable species of man, and then to advocate that order with all the art and science at his disposal. Nietzsche saw two lines of life, an ascending and a descending line. At the end of the one, he pictured an ideal type, robust in mind and body, rich enough in spirit and vigor to make giving and bestowing a necessary condition of its existence. At the end of the other line, he already perceived degeneracy, poverty of blood and spirit, and a sufficiently low degree of vitality to make parasitism a biological need. He believed that the first or noble morality, when it prevailed, made for an ascending line of life and therefore favored the multiplication of a desirable type of man. And he was now equally convinced that whenever ignoble or slave morality was supreme, life not only tended to follow the descending line, but that the very men whose existence it favored were the least likely to stem the declining tide. Hence it seemed to him that the most essential of all tasks was to ascertain what kind of morality now prevailed in order that we might immediately transvalue our values while there was still time if we believed this change to be necessary. What then are our present values? Nietzsche replies most emphatically, they are Christian values. In the last chapter, we saw that although Christian dogma was very rapidly becoming mere wreckage, its most earnest opposers and destroyers nevertheless clung with fanatical faith to Christian morality. Thus, in addition to the vast multitude of those professing the old religion, there was also a host of atheists, agnostics, rationalists, and materialists who, as far as Nietzsche was concerned, could quite logically be classed with those who were avowedly Christian. And as for the remainder, a few indifferent and perhaps nameless people, what could they matter? Even they, perhaps, if hard pressed, would have betrayed a sneaking, cowardly trust in Christian ethics, if only out of a sense of security, and with these the total sum of the civilized world was fully made up. Perhaps to some this may appear a somewhat sweeping conclusion. To such, as doubt its justice, the best advice that can be given is to urge them to consult the literature, ethical, philosophical, and otherwise, of those writers whom they would consider most opposed to Christianity before the publication of Nietzsche's works, and they will then realize that, with very few exceptions, mostly to be found among uninfluential and uncreative iconoclasts, the whole of the Western civilized world in Nietzsche's time was firmly Christian in morals, and most firmly so, perhaps, in those very quarters where the dogma of the religion of pity was most honestly disclaimed. It had therefore become in the highest degree necessary to put these values under the philosophical microscope and to discover to which order they belonged. Was Christianity the purveyor of a noble or of a slave morality? The reply to this question would reveal the whole tendency of the modern world and would also answer Nietzsche's searching inquiry. Are we on the right track? Pursuing Nietzsche's method as closely as we can, let us now turn to Christianity as we find it today and see whether it is possible to bring its values into line with one of the two broad classes spoken of in this chapter. In the first place, Nietzsche discovers that Christianity is not a world-approving faith. The very pivot upon which it revolves seems to be the slandering and depreciating of this world, together with the praise and exaltation of a hypothetical world to come. To his mind, it seems to draw odious comparisons between the things of this earth and the blessings of heaven. Finally, it gushes in a very unsportsmanlike manner over an imaginary beyond to the detriment and disadvantage of a here of this earth, of this life, and posits another region, a nether region for the accommodation of its enemies. 2. What now is the mental attitude of these backworldsmen, as Nietzsche calls them, who can see only the world's filth? Who is likely to need the thought of a beyond where he will live in bliss while those he hates will writhe in hell? Such ideas occur only to certain minds. Do they occur to the minds of those who, by the very health, strength, and happiness that is in them, transfigure all the world, even the ugliness in it, and declare it to be beautiful? Do they occur to the powerful who can chastise their enemies while their blood is still up, admitting that the world may be surveyed from 100 different standpoints? Is this particular standpoint which we now have under our notice that of a contented, optimistic, sanguine type, or that of a discontented, pessimistic, anemic one? To the pure all things are pure. I, however, say unto you, to the swine all things are swinish. 3. Nietzsche's sensitive car caught curious notes in the daily dronings of those around him, notes that made him suspicious of the whole melody, of modern life, and still more suspicions of the chorus executing it. He heard to his astonishment. The wretched alone are the good, the poor, the impotent, the lowly alone are good, only the sufferers. The needy, the sick, the ugly are pious, only they are godly, them alone, blessedness awaits. But ye, the proud and potent, ye are for aye, and evermore the wicked, the cruel, the lustful, the insatiable, the godless. You will also be to all eternity the unblessed, the cursed, and the damned. 4. He continued listening intently, and with his ear attuned anew, these sentiments broke strangely upon his senses. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. 5. There was no time for brooding over stray thoughts. There was still much to be seen and heard. When you want to catch someone napping, you keep your eye eagerly upon him and turn neither to the right nor to the left. Nietzsche, it must be remembered, was at this stage treading softly towards Europe, whom he believed to be napping. In his lonely hermit cell, he was able to catch all the sounds that rose from the city beneath him, and he heard perhaps more than the inhabitants themselves. He could see them all fighting and quarreling, and he was cheered, because he knew that where the great fight for power ceases, the standard of life falls. But some he saw were wounded, others were actually unfit for the battlefield, a large number looked tired and listless, and there were yet others, a goodly multitude, who were resentful at the sight of their superiors, and who, like sulky children, dropped their arms in a pet and declared that they would not play any more. And what were all these feeble and less viable mortals doing? They were crying aloud and making their deepest wishes known. They were elevating their desiderata to the highest places amongst earthly virtues and driving back the others with words. Nietzsche thought of Reynard the Fox, who, at the very moment that he was about to be hanged and with the rope already round his neck, succeeded by his dialectical skill in persuading the crowd to release him. For Nietzsche could hear the weary, the wounded, and the incapable of the fight, crying quite distinctly through their lips parched for rest, "Peace is good, love is good, love for one's neighbor is good, aye, and even love for one's enemy is good." 6. And some cried, "It is God that avengeth me," to those who oppressed them, and others said, "The Lord avenge me." 7. Whereupon Nietzsche thought of the Jehovah of the Old Testament, the God of revenge and thunderbolts. He recalled the sentiment, "Ye shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword." And he wondered how this had come to mean, "Love your enemies," in the New Testament. Had another type of men perhaps made themselves gods, mouthpiece? Yes, that must be so, for in their holy book he came across this passage, ascribed to one of their greatest saints, "Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that in the wisdom of God the world by wisdom knew God, it pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. Not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty, and base things of the world, and things which are despised, hath God chosen, yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught things that are." 8. Here Nietzsche tells us he began to hold his nose, but he still listened, for there was yet more to be heard. From the smiles that were breaking over the lips of those who read the above words, he gathered that they must have overcome their unhappiness. Yes, indeed they had, but what did they call it? This was important. Even the Christian view of unhappiness seemed significant to Nietzsche in this inquiry. Their unhappiness, their wretchedness, they called a trial, a gift, a distinction. Not really. Yes, indeed. As Nietzsche points out, they are wretched, no doubt, all these mumblers and underground forgers, though warmly seated together. But they tell us their wretchedness is a selection and distinction from God, that the dogs which are loved most are whipped, that their misery may perhaps also be a preparation, a trial, a schooling, perhaps even more, something which at some time to come will be refuted and paid back with immense interest in gold. No, in happiness, this they call blessedness. 9. At this point, Nietzsche declares that he could stand it no longer. "Enough, enough, bad air," he cried. "Methinks this workshop of virtue positively reeks." He had now realized in whose company he had been all this time, these people who halted at nothing in order to elevate their weaknesses to the highest place among the virtues and to monopolize goodness on earth, who called that good which was tame and soft and harmless, because they themselves could only survive in litters of cotton wool, who colored the earth with the darkness that was in their own bodies, who did not scruple to dub all manly and vital virtues odiously, sinful and wicked, and who preferred to set the life of the whole world at stake, rather than acknowledge that it was precisely their own second-rate, third-rate, or even fourth-rate vitality which was the greatest sin of all, who in one and the same breath preached their utilitarian, universal love to the powerful, and then sent them to eternal damnation in another world. Nietzsche asks, are these people the supporters of a noble or of a slave morality? The answer is obvious, and we need not labor the point. But it was so obvious to the lonely hermit that the thought of it filled him with horror and dread, and he was moved to leave his cell and to descend into the plain while there was yet time, with the object of urging us to transvalue our values. In Christian Values, Nietzsche read nihilism, decadence, degeneration, and death. They were calculated to favor the multiplication of the least desirable on earth, and as such, despite his antecedents, and with his one desire, the elevation of the type man, always, before him, he condemned Christian morality from top to bottom. This magnificent attempt on the part of the low, the base, and the worthless to establish themselves as the most powerful on earth must be checked at all costs, and with terrible earnestness he exhorts us to alter our values. O my brethren, with whom lieth the greatest danger to the whole human future, is it not with the good and the just? Break up, I pray you, the good and the just. This condemnation of Christian values as slave values, which Nietzsche regarded as his greatest service to mankind, he says he would write on all walls. He tells us he came just in the nick of time, tomorrow might be too late. It is time for man to fix his goal. It is time for man to plant the germ of his highest hope. His soil is still rich enough for that purpose, but that soil will one day be too poor and exhausted, and no lofty tree will any longer be able to grow thereon. 10, 1g, EP 227, 2, John Roman 12, 25, 1 John Roman 2, 15, 16, James Roman 4, 4, 3, z, P 249, 4, g, M, first essay, APH. 7, 5, Matthew V, 6, Matthew Roman 23, 39, Mark Roman 13, 31, Luke X 27, Matthew V, 44, 7, 2 Luke Roman 18, 7, 8, Romans Roman 12, L 9, Revelation Roman 6, 10, 8, I Corinthians I 20, 21, 26, 27, 28, 9, g, M, first essay, APH, 14, see also Epistle to the Hebrews Roman 12, 6, and Revelation Roman 3, 19, 10. Z, P 12, Chapter IV, Nietzsche the Evolutionist. Transvalue your values or perish. This was the message of the hermit Nietzsche to the people inhabiting the valley into which he had descended. Transvalue your values, that is to say, make them what they once were, noble, life-approving, virile. For 2,000 years, the role of the world wheel had been reversed. Stendhal had said that many years before Nietzsche lived, but it was left to Nietzsche, Stendhal's admirer and pupil, to teach and prove this fact. Stendhal, too, had cried out against the tameness, the lukewarmness, the effeminacy of society. But Nietzsche took up this cry with a voice more brazen than Stendhal's at a time when mankind was in much greater need of it. Stendhal had pointed enthusiastically to the sun and to the passion of the South, and had donned a moral respirator whenever he turned to face the gray and depressing atmosphere of northern ideas and northern tepidness. Nietzsche follows his master's hint with alacrity, but in doing so converts Stendhal's clarion notes into thunder and the glint of Stendhal's rapier into strokes of lightning. 1. When Nietzsche began to write, Europe was suffering from the worst kind of spiritual illness, weakness of will. Everywhere comfort and freedom from danger were becoming the highest ideals. Everywhere, too, virtue was being confounded with those qualities which led to the highest possible amount of security and tame back parlor pleasures, and man was gradually developing into a harmless domesticated type of animal, capable of performing a host of charming little drawing room tricks, which rejoiced the hearts of his womenfolk. Sleep seemed to be the greatest accomplishment. It had become all important to have a good night's rest, and everything was done to achieve this end. A man no longer asked his heart what it dictated. When he stood irresolute before a daring deed, he simply consulted Morpheus, who warned him that he could not promise him a soft pillow if he did anything that was ever so slightly naughty. In the end, Morpheus would prevail, and thus all Europe was beginning to snore peacefully the whole night through with marvelous regularity, while manliness rotted and danger dwindled too. Nietzsche protested against this state of affairs. What is good? Ye ask, to be brave is good. Let the little schoolgirls say, to be good is sweet and touching at the same time. Ye say, a good cause will hallow even war. I say unto you, a good war halloweth every cause. war and courage have done greater things than love. 3. I pass through this people and keep mine eyes open. They have become smaller and ever become smaller. The reason thereof is their doctrine of happiness and virtue. For they are moderate also in virtue, because they want comfort. With comfort, however, moderate virtue only is compatible. Of man there is little here. Therefore do their women make themselves manly. For only he who is man enough will save the woman in woman. In their hearts, they want simply one thing most of all, that no one hurt them. That, however, is cowardice, though it be called virtue. 4. Some there were, of course, who were conscious of the dreadful condition of things and who deplored it without, however, being able to put their finger on the root of the evil. Such people were most of them pessimists, and at the time that Nietzsche lived, Schopenhauer was their leader. Sensitive, noble-minded, artistic people, deprived by rationalistic and atheistic teachers of the belief in God, felt the ignobleness of European hopes and aspirations, and knowing of no better creed, and possessing the intelligence to see the hopelessness of things under the rule of the values which then prevailed, they succumbed to a mood of utter despair, subscribed to Schopenhauer's horror and loathing of the world, and regarded the very optimism of childhood with suspicion and scorn. For a while Nietzsche, too, was an ardent and devoted follower of Schopenhauer. Godlessness was bad enough to endure, but godlessness in a world of unpagan and effeminate manhood was too much for the loving student of classical antiquity, and he turned to Schopenhauer as to one who, he thought, would understand how to steel his heart against life's misery. But this opiate did not maintain its sway over Nietzsche long. Our poet was of a type too courageous and too vigorous to be able to surrender himself so completely to sorrow and to Buddhistic consolations. Gradually, he began to regard the humble and resigned attitude of the pessimist before life's hardships and modernity's grayness as unworthy of a spirited and active man. Slowly, it dawned upon him that the root of the evil lay not in the constitution of the earth, but in man himself and in man's actual values. If man could be roused to pursue higher ideals, if he could be moved to kill the poisonous snake of ignoble values that had crawled into his throat and choked him while he was in slumber 5. In fact, if man could surpass himself and regard the reversal of the world's engines for the last 2,000 years, as Stendhal had done, that is to say, as the grossest error and most ridiculous faux pas that had ever been made, then, Nietzsche thought, pessimism and Schopenhauer might go to the deuce, and conscious, sensitive, intellectual, and artistic Europe would once more be able to smile instead of shuddering at the thought of mankind's former qualities. Thus, it was the condemnation of modern values, together with the thought of man's being able to surpass himself, which gave Nietzsche the grounds and the necessary strength for abandoning pessimism and embracing that wise optimism which characterizes the whole of his works, after the joyful wisdom. True, God was dead, but that ought only to make man feel more self-reliant, more creative, prouder. Undoubtedly, God was dead, but man could now hold himself responsible for himself. He could now seek a goal in manhood on earth, and one that was at least within the compass of his powers. Long enough had he squinted heavenwards, with the result that he had neglected his task on earth. 6. Dead are all gods, Nietzsche cries. Now we will that Superman live. 7. We are now before Nietzsche the evolutionist, and we must define him relatively to those other evolutionists with whom we, as English people, are already familiar. To begin with, then, let us dispose of the fundamental question, Nietzsche's concept of life. We have had life variously defined for us by our own writers, and perhaps one among Nietzsche's greatest contemporaries in England, Herbert Spencer, defined it in the most characteristically English fashion. Spencer said, "Life is activity, or the continuous adjustment of internal relations to external relations." Now, there is absolutely nothing in either of these definitions, no suggestion or hint which would lead the most suspicious to conjecture what life really is. Activity reveals nothing of life's passions, its hate, its envy, its covetousness, its hard, inexorable principles, the process of the continual adjustments of internal relations to external relations might mean the serpent's digestion of its prey, or the training of an opera singer's voice, and it might also be a scientific formula for a moral order of things. Both definitions are delightfully unheroic and vague, though they do not compromise the writer, they compromise with everything else, and to start out with them is to shelve the question in a way which allows of our subsequently weaving all the romance and sweetness possible into life, and of making it as pretty as a little nursery story. Nietzsche, always eager for a practical and tangible idea, naturally, could not accept these two definitions as expressing anything profound about life at all. Looking into the race of nature and reading her, history from the amoeba with its predatory pseudopodia to the lion, with its murderous prehensile claws, he defined life practically, uprightly, and bravely as appropriation, injury, conquest of the strange and weak, suppression, severity, obtrusion of its own forms. Incorporation, and at least putting it mildest, exploitation. 8. Thus, as we see from the start, Nietzsche closes his eyes at nothing. He does not want life to be a pretty tale if it is not one. He wants to know it as it is, for he is convinced that this is the only way of arriving at sound principles as to the manner in which human existence should be led. Appropriation, then, he takes as a fact. He does not argue it away, any more than he tries to argue away injury, conquest of the strange and weak, suppression and incorporation. These things are only too apparent, and he states them bravely in his definition. We know life is all this, but how much more comfortable it is when we are sitting in our soft, easy chairs before our cheerful fires to think that life is merely activity, to believe that there is a moral order in the universe is to believe that these unpleasant things in Nietzsche's definition will one day be overcome. This was the position Christianity assumed from the start. Put though it was excusable in a religion fighting for power, and compelled to use nice and attractive words for its followers, to suppose that all the misery on earth will one day be transformed by God's wisdom into perfect bliss, such an attitude is quite unpardonable in the case of a philosopher or even of a poet. When Browning chanted, smugly, "God's in his heaven, all's right with the world," he confessed himself a mediocre spirit with one stroke of the pen. And when Spencer wrote that the blind process of evolution must inevitably favor all changes of nature which increase life and augment happiness, he did the same. We may now perhaps understand Nietzsche's impatience of his predecessors and contemporaries who refused to see precisely what he saw in the face of nature. But even in his extended definition of life, the modern biologist brings himself no nearer to Nietzsche's honest standpoint, and for the following reasons. The modern biologist says this activity he speaks of has a precise meaning. It connotes the struggle for existence, or in other words, self-defense. Again, he is looking at life through moral or Christian glasses, because if everything on earth is done in self-defense, even the devil himself is argued out of existence and God remains creator of the good alone. Nietzsche replies by denying this flatly. He says that the definition is again inadequate. He warns us not to confound Malthus with nature. 9. He admits that the struggle occurs, but only as an exception. The general aspect of life is not a state of want or hunger. It is rather a state of opulence, luxuriance, and even absurd prodigality. Where there is a struggle, it is a struggle for power. Will to power and not will to live is the motive force of life. Wherever I found living matter, he says, I found will to power, and even in the servant, I found the yearning to be master. Only where there is life, there is will, though a not will to live, but thus I teach thee, will to power. 10. Is there no aggression without the struggle for existence? Is there no voluptuousness in a position of power for us own sake? Of course, there is. And one wonders how these English biologists could ever have been schoolboys without noticing these facts. As Nietzsche points out, however, they are every one of them laboring under the Christian ideal still, in spite of all their upsetting of the first chapter of Genesis and in spite of all their blasting of the miracles. Put, if life is the supreme aim of all, how is it that many things are valued higher than life by living beings, if the will to live sometimes finds itself overpowered by another will, more particularly in great warriors, great prophets, great artists, and great heroes? What is this mightier force which thus overpowers it? We have heard what Nietzsche calls it. It is the will to power. Psychologists should bethink themselves before putting down the instinct of self-preservation as the cardinal instinct of an organic being. A living thing seeks above all to discharge its strength. Life itself is will to power. Self-preservation is only one of the indirect and most frequent results thereof. 11. In spite of everything we have already said, Nietzsche's disagreement with our own biologists may still seem to many but a play upon words. A moment's meditation, however, more particularly over the passage just quoted, will show that it is really much deeper than this. It is one thing to regard an animal as a mere automaton, prowling around to satisfy its hunger and happy to remain inactive when the sensation of hunger is appeased, and quite another to regard an animal as a battery, of accumulated forces which must be discharged at all costs and for good or evil, with only temporary lapses of purely self-preservative desires and self-preservative actions. All the different consequences of these two views will occur to the thinker in an instant. Upon this basis, then, the will to power, Nietzsche builds up a cosmogony which also assumes that species have been evolved. But again, in the processes of that evolution, he is at variance with Darwin and all the natural selectionists. Nietzsche cannot be persuaded that mechanical adjustment to ambient conditions or adaptation to environment, both purely passive, meek, and uncreative functions, should be given the importance as determining factors which the English and German schools give them. With Samuel Butler, he protests against this pitchforking of mind and spirit out of the universe and points imperatively to an inner creative will in living organisms which ultimately makes environment and natural conditions subservient and subject. In the Genealogy of Morals, 12, he makes it quite clear that he would ascribe the greatest importance to a power in the organism itself, to the highest functionaries in the animal, in which the life will appears as an active and formative principle, and that even in the matter of the mysterious occurrence of varieties, sports, he would seek for inner causes. Darwin himself threw out only a hint in this direction. That is why it is safe to suppose that if Nietzsche and Darwin are ever reconciled, it will probably be precisely on this ground. In The Origin of Species, speaking of the causes of variability, Darwin said, "There are two factors, namely the nature of the organism and the nature of the conditions. The former seem to be much the more important." 13. For nearly similar variations sometimes arise under, as far as we can judge, dissimilar conditions, and on the other hand, dissimilar variations arise under conditions which appear to be uniform. Thus, differing widely from the orthodox school of evolutionists, Nietzsche nevertheless believed their hypothesis to be sound. But once more, he has an objection to raise. Why did they halt where they halted if the process is a fact, if things have become what they are and have not always been so? Then why should we rest on our oars? If it was possible for man to struggle up from barbarism and still more, remotely from the lower primates and reach the zenith of his physical development, why, Nietzsche asks, should he not surpass himself and attain to Superman by evolving in the same degree volitionally and mentally? The most careful ask today, how is man preserved? But Zarathustra asketh as the only and first one, how is man surpassed? 14. All beings in your genealogical ladder have created something beyond themselves, and are ye going to be the ebb of this great tide? Behold, I teach you Superman. 15. And now again, at the risk of being monotonous, I must point to yet another difference between Nietzsche and the prevailing school of evolutionists. Whereas the latter, in their unscrupulous optimism, believed that out of the chaotic play of blind forces something highly desirable and good would ultimately be evolved, whereas they tacitly, though not avowedly, believed that their fittest in the struggle for existence would eventually prove to be the best. In fact, that we should muddle through to perfection somehow, and that something really noble and important would be sure to result from John Brown's contest with Harry Smith for the highest place in an insurance office. For instance, Nietzsche disbelieved from the bottom of his heart in this chance play of blind and meaningless tendencies. He said, given a degenerate, mean, and base environment and the fittest to survive, therein will be the man who is best adapted to degeneracy, meanness, and baseness, therefore the worst kind of man. Given a community of parasites, and it may be that the flattest, the slimiest, and the softest will be the fittest to survive. Such faith in blind forces, Nietzsche regarded merely as the survival of the old Christian belief in the moral order of things, fogged out in scientific apparel to suit modern tastes. He saw plainly that if man were to be elevated at all, no blind struggle in his present conditions would ever affect that end, for the present conditions themselves make those the fittest to survive in them who are persons of absolutely undesirable gifts and propensities. He declared, and here we are in the very heart of Nietzscheism, that nothing but a total change in these conditions, a complete transvaluation of all values, would ever alter man and make him more worthy of his past. For it is values, values, and again values that mold men and rear men and create men, and ignoble values make ignoble men, and noble values make noble men. Thus it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, truth without end for men. Nietzsche realized all that could still be made out of man through a favorable accumulation and augmentation of human powers and arrangements. He knew how unexhausted man still is for the greatest, possibilities, and how often in the past the type man has stood in mysterious and dangerous crossways and has launched forth upon the right or the wrong road, impelled merely by a whim or by a hint from the giant chance. 16. And now he was determined that, whether man wished to listen or not, at least he should be told of the ultimate disaster that awaited him if he continued in his present direction. For there was yet time. It is to higher men that Nietzsche really makes his appeal, the leaders and misleaders of the mob. He had no concern with the multitude, and they did not need him. The world had seen philosophies enough which had advocated the cause of the greatest number. English libraries were stacked with such works. What was required was to convert those rare men who give the direction, the heads of the various throngs, the vanguard. Awake and listen, ye lonely ones. From the future, winds are coming, with a gentle beating of wings, and there cometh good tidings for fine ears. Ye lonely ones of today, ye who stand apart, ye shall one day be a people. From you who have chosen yourselves, a chosen people shall arise, and from it Superman. 17. 1 G. E. A. P. H. 254, 255, 256, 2. See Schopenhauer on the Vanity and Suffering of Life. 3, Z, P 52, 4, Z, PP, 204, 205, 206, 5, Z, PP, 192, 193, 6, C, Z, P 98, et sec. 7, Z, P 91, 8, G, E, P 226, 9. Twilight of the Idols, Part 9, APH, 14, 10, Z, PP, 136, 137, 11, G, EP 2012, Second Essay APH, L2 13, The Italics Are Mine. AML 14, Z, P 351 15, Z, P 6 16, G, EP 130 17, Z, P 89, Chapter V, Nietzsche the Sociologist. For Nietzsche, as we are beginning to see, a fitting title is hard to find. Unless we coin new names for things that have not yet been given names, Nietzsche remains without a title among his fellow thinkers. He has been called the arch-anarchist, which he is not. He has been called the preacher of brutality, which he is not. He has been called the egoist, which he is not. But all these titles were conferred upon him by people whose interest it was to reduce him in the public's esteem. If he must be named, however, and we suppose he must, the best title would obviously be that which would distinguish him most exactly from his colleagues. Now, how does Nietzsche stand out from the ranks of almost all other philosophers? By the fact that he was throughout his life an advocate of higher man. Whereas other philosophers and scholars had always thought they had some divine message to impart in the cause of the greatest number, Nietzsche, the typical minor and underminer, believed that his mission was to stand for a neglected minority, for higher men, for the gold in the mass of quartz. No title, therefore, could be more fair and at the same time more essentially descriptive than the advocate of higher man, and in giving this title to Nietzsche, we immediately outline him against that assembly of his colleagues who were advocates of the greatest number. It is of the first importance to humanity that its higher individuals should be allowed to attain their full development, for only by means of its heroes can the human race be led forward step by step to higher and ever higher levels. In view of the fact that Nietzsche realized this, some of his principles, when given general application, may very naturally appear to be both iniquitous and subversive, and those who read him with the idea that he is preaching a gospel for all are perfectly justified if they turn away in horror from his works. The mistake they make, however, is to suppose that he, like most other philosophers with whom they are familiar, is an advocate of the greatest number. Let us take a single instance. In The Honey Sacrifice, 1, the phrase, "Become what thou art," occurs. Now it is obvious that, however legitimate this command may be when applied to the highest and best, it becomes dangerous and seditious when applied to each individual of the mass of mankind. And this explains the number of errors that are rife concerning Nietzsche's gospel. Whenever Nietzsche spoke esoterically, his enemies declared that he was pronouncing maxims for the greatest number. Whenever he spoke for the greatest number, as he does again and again in his allusions to the mediocre, he was accused of speaking esoterically. How would any other philosophy have fared under such misrepresentation and calumny? Nietzsche could not believe in equality, for within him justice said, "Men are not equal." Those to whom it gives pleasure to think that men are equal, he conjures not to confound pleasure with truth, and like Professor Huxley, he finds himself obliged to recognize the natural inequality of men. But far from deploring this fact, he would fain have accentuated and intensified it. This inequality to Nietzsche is a condition to be exploited and to be made use of by the legislator, the higher men, of a society in which gradations of rank are recognized as a natural and desirable condition constitute the class in which the hopes of a real elevation of humanity may be placed. The divine Manu, Laozi, Confucius, Mohammed, Jesus Christ, all these men, who in their sublime arrogance actually converted man into a mirror in which they saw themselves and their doctrines reflected, and who in thus converting man into a mirror really made him feel happy in the function of reflecting alone. These leaders are the types Nietzsche refers to when he speaks of higher men, ruling, like all other functions which require the great to justify them, has fallen into disrepute, thanks to the incompetent amateurs that have tried their hand at the game. As in the fine arts, so in leading and ruling, it is the dilettantes that have broken our faith in human performances. The really great ruler reaches his zenith in dominating an epoch, a party, a nation, or the world to the best advantage of each of these, but it does not follow that the motive, power propelling him, should necessarily be the conscious pursuit of the best advantage of those he rules. This is merely a fortuitous circumstance curiously associated with greatness in ruling. Generally speaking, however, his only conscious motive is the gratification of his inordinate will to power. The innocent fallacy of democracy lies in supposing that by a mere search, by a mere rummaging and fumbling among a motley populace, one man or several men can be found who are able to take the place of the rare and ideal ruler. As if the mere fact of searching and rummaging were not in itself a confession of failure, a confession that this man does not exist. For if he existed, he would have asserted himself, he would have needed no democratic exploration party to unearth him. There is no sorer misfortune in all human destiny than when the powerful of the earth are not at the same time the first men. Then everything becometh false and warped and monstrous. 2. For my brethren, the best shall rule, the best will rule, and where the teaching is different, there the best is lacking. 3. Here we observe that Nietzsche advocated an aristocratic arrangement of society. A firm believer in tradition, law, and order, and in spite of his opponent's accusations, an undaunted enemy of anarchy and Laissez-Faire. He saw in socialism and democracy nothing more than two slave organizations for the raising of every individual to his highest power, individuality made as general as possible, or, in other words, socialism and democracy meant to Nietzsche the annihilation of all higher aims and hopes. It meant valuing all the weeds and noble plants alike, and with such evaluation, the noble plants, being in the minority, must necessarily suffer and ultimately die out. Where everybody is somebody, nobody is anybody. Socialism, i.e. organized individualism, seemed to Nietzsche merely the reflection in politics of the Christian principle that all men are alike before God. Grant immortality to every Tom, Dick, and Harry, and in the end, every Tom, Dick, or Harry will believe in equal rights before he can even hope to reach heaven. But to deny the privileges of rare men implies the prescription from life of all high trees with broad brandies, those broad brandies that protect the herd from the rain, but which also keep the sun from the envious and ambitious shrub, and thus it would mean that the world would gradually assume the appearance of those vast Scotch moors of gorse and heather, where liberalism and mediocrity are rampant, but where all loftiness is dead. Nietzsche was a profound believer in the value of tradition, in the value of general discipline lasting over long periods. He knew that all that is great and lasting and intensely moving has been the result of the law of castes, or of the laws governing the individual members of a caste throughout many generations. 4. This building up of the rare man, of the great man, of the cultivated type in a Darwinian sense, as every scientist is aware, is utterly frustrated by anything in the way of injudicious and careless crossbreeding. See Darwin on the degeneration of the cultivated types of animals through the action of promiscuous breeding, by democratic mesalliances of all kinds, and by the Laissez-Faire. All are which is one of the worst evils of that kind of freedom which tends to prevail when the slaves of a community have succeeded in asserting and expressing their insignificant and miserable little individualities. Believing all this, Nietzsche could not help but advocate the rearing of a select and aristocratic caste, and in none of his exhortations is he more sincere than when he appeals to higher men to sow the seeds of a nobility for the future. O my brethren, I consecrate you to be, and show unto you the way unto a now nobility. Ye shall become procreators and breeders and sowers of the future Verily, ye shall not become a nobility one might buy, like shopkeepers, with shopkeepers' gold. For all that hath its fixed price is of little worth, not whence ye come be your honor in future, but whither ye go. Your will and your foot that longeth to get beyond yourselves, be that your new honor. Your children's land ye shall love, be this your new nobility, the land undiscovered in the remotest sea, for it I bid you set sail and seek. 5. Every elevation of the type man, says Nietzsche, has hitherto been the work of an aristocratic society, and so will it always be. A. Society believing in a long scale of gradations of rank and differences, of worth among human beings, and requiring slavery in some form or other, without the pathos of distance, such as grows out of the incarnated differences of classes, out of the constant outlooking and downlooking of the ruling caste on subordinates and instruments, and out of their equally constant practice of obeying and commanding, of keeping down and keeping at a distance that other more mysterious pathos could never have arisen, the longing for an ever new widening distance within the soul itself, the formation of ever higher, rarer, further, more extended, more comprehensive states, in short, just the elevation of the type man, the continued self-surmounting of man, to use a moral formula in a supermoral sense. 6. I cannot attempt to give a full account of the society Nietzsche would fain have seen established on earth. It will be found exhaustively described in APH 57 of The Antichrist, while in the Book of Manu, Max Müller's Sacred Books of the East, number 25, similar sociological prescriptions are to be found, correlated with all the imposing machinery of divine revelation, supernatural authority, and religious earnestness. Briefly, Nietzsche says this: it is ridiculous to pretend to treat everyone without regard to those natural distinctions which are manifested by superior intellectuality, or exceptional muscular strength, or mediocrity of spiritual and bodily powers, or inferiority of both. He tells us that it is not the legislator, but nature herself, who establishes these broad classes, and to ignore them when forming a society would be just as foolish as to ignore the order of rank among materials and structural principles when building a monument. Though the base of a pyramid does not require to be of the very finest marble, we know it must be both broad and massive. Nietzsche declares that no society has any solidarity which is not founded upon a broad basis of mediocrity. Though the stones get fewer in the layers as we ascend to the top of the pyramid, we know that their gradation is necessary if the highest point is to be readied. Nietzsche believes in the long scale of gradations of rank, with the ascending line leading always to the highest, even if he be only a single individual. Though the very uppermost point consists of a single stone, it is around that single stone that the weather will rage most furiously and the sun shine most gorgeously. That single stone will be the first to cleave the heavy shower and the first for to meet the lightning. Nietzsche says, life always becomes harder towards the summit. The cold increases, responsibility increases. 7. Sepius ventis agitator ingens, pinnis et celsi gravior caju, dissident ters firiunc samos. Fulgura montes. 8. Horace carm, II, X. Thus he would have the intellectually superior, those who can bear responsibility and endure hardships at the head. Beneath them are the warriors, the physically strong, who are the guardians of right, the keepers of order and security. The king above all is the highest, formula of warrior, judge, and keeper of the law. The second in rank are the executive of the most intellectual. And below this caste are the mediocre. Handicraft, trade, agriculture, science, the greater part of art, in a word, the whole compass of business activity, is exclusively compatible with an average amount of ability and pretension. At the very base of the social edifice, Nietzsche sees the class of man who thrives best when he is well looked after and closely observed, the man who is happy to serve, not because he must, but because he is what he is, the man uncorrupted by political and religious lies concerning equality, liberty, and fraternity, who is half conscious of the abyss which separates him from his superiors, and who is happiest when performing those acts which are not beyond his limitations. He forestalls this sketch of his ideal society by enunciating the moral code wherewith he would transvalue our present values, and I shall now give this code without a single remark or comment, feeling quite sure that the reader who has understood Nietzsche so far will not require any assistance in seeing that it is the necessary and logical outcome of the rest of his teaching. What is good? All that increases the feeling of power, will to power, power itself in man. What is bad? All that proceeds from weakness. What is happiness? The feeling that power increases, that resistance is overcome. Not contentedness, but more power, not peace at any price, but warfare, not virtue, but capacity, virtue in the Renaissance style, virtue free from any moralic acid. 9. I cannot well close this chapter on Nietzsche's sociological views without touching upon two of the most important elements in modern society and his treatment of them. I refer to altruism and to pity. I am more particularly anxious to express myself clearly on these two points, inasmuch as I know how many erroneous opinions are current in regard to Nietzsche's attitude towards them. In all gregarious communities, as is well known, altruism and pity have become very potent life-preserving factors, and it would be hard to find in Europe today a city, a town, or a village in which these two qualities are not considered the most creditable of virtues. Now, apart from the fact that this excessive praise of compassion and selflessness is a sign of slave values being in the ascendant, we must bear in mind two things. One, that under our present system of society, in which cruelties are perpetrated far more brutal than any that could be found in antiquity, a sort of maudlin sentimentality has arisen among the oppressing classes, whereby they attempt to counterbalance their deeds of oppression with lavish acts of charity. This sentimentality is a sign that their conscience is no longer clean for the act of oppressing, because in their heart of hearts they feel themselves unworthy of being at the top. Two, that wherever two or three human beings collect together, a certain modicum of altruism and compassion is a prerequisite of their social unity, dismissing observation one as the mere expression of a regrettable fact which scarcely requires substantiation and which is responsible for more than three quarters of the anomalies that characterize modern Western civilization, and passing over the suggestion that the excessive praise of compassion and selflessness denotes an ascendancy of slave values, for we have dealt with this question in chapter III. Let us turn to the more abstract proposition enunciated in observation 2 and try to grasp Nietzsche's treatment of it. In the first place, let us understand that there are two kinds of pity and selflessness, just as there are two kinds of generosity. There is the pity, the selflessness, and the generosity which is preached and praised as a virtue by him who urgently requires them because he is ill-constituted, needy, and hungry. And there is the pity, the selflessness, and the generosity which suggests itself to the man, overflowing with health, trust in the future, and confidence in his own powers. To such a man, pity, selflessness, and generosity are a means of discharging a certain plenitude of power, and in his case, giving and bestowing are natural functions. In the first instance, the three virtues are preached from a utilitarian standpoint, which tends to increase an undesirable type. In the second, they are the sign of the existence of a desirable type. Let us hear Nietzsche, a man who says, "I like that, I take it for my own and mean to guard it and protect it from everyone." And the man who can conduct a case, carry out a resolution, remain true to an opinion, keep hold of a woman, punish and overthrow insolence, a man who has his indignation and his sword, and to whom the weak, the suffering, the oppressed, and even the animals willingly submit and naturally belong, in short, a man who is a master by nature, when such a man has sympathy, well, that sympathy has value. But of what account is the sympathy of those who suffer, or of those even who preach sympathy, wherever we find anything akin to pity, even in nature? The suckling of the young, the maintenance of dependence, the lion's attitude towards the jackal, the protection of the helpless young, as in many fish and mammals, it is always the superabundance of the giver and his will to power which creates the pitiful act. But the pity which most of us understand as a virtue in Europe today is merely a sort of sickly sensitiveness and irritability towards pain, an effeminate absence of control in the presence of suffering, which has nothing whatever to do with our powers of alleviating the misery we contemplate, and which is only compatible either with excessive sentimentality or with weak and overstrained nerves. In that case, all it does is to add to the misery of this world and to elevate to a virtue that which is perhaps one of the saddest signs of the times. It is then indiscriminate, rash, and short-sighted, and gives rise to more evil than it tries to dispel. Ah, where in the world have there been greater follies than with the pitiful? And what in the world hath caused more suffering than the follies of the pitiful? Woe unto all loving ones who have not an elevation which is above their pity. 10. The legislator or the leader, and it is to him, remember, that Nietzsche appeals, is often obliged to leave dozens to die by the wayside, and has to do so with a clean conscience. If the march he is organizing requires certain sacrifices he must be ready to make, them. The slavish pity, then, which would sacrifice the greater to the less, must have been overcome by him in his own heart, and he must have learnt that hardness which is wider in its sympathies, more presbyopic in its love, and less immediate in its effect. But he alone can feel like this who has something to give to those he leads, i.e., his protection and guidance, his promise of a better land. Myself I would sacrifice to my design, and my neighbor as well, such is the language of creators. All creators, however, are hard. 11. Now turning to the question of egoism, cruet vert, which, according to some, is the very basis and core of Nietzscheism, what are the points which strike us most in Nietzsche's standpoint? To begin with, in this question, as in all others, his honesty is paramount, and we become conscious of it the moment we read his first line on the subject, where Nietzsche discusses matters of which others are wont to speak with heaving breasts, florid language, and tearful voices. He takes particular pains to be clear, concise, calculating, and cold. Hence, perhaps, the hatred he has provoked in those who depend for their effect upon the impression of benevolence which their watery eyes, their cracked, good-natured voices, and their highfalutin words make upon a multitude. Nietzsche puts his linger on the very center of the question of egoism. He simply says, not everyone has the right to be an egoist. Whereas, in some egoism would be a virtue, in others it may be an insufferable vice which should be stamped out at all costs. In whom, then, is egoism a vice? Obviously in him who is physiologically botched, below mediocrity in spirit and body, mean, despicable, and even ugly. Egoism in such a man means concentrating certain interests, and not always the least valuable, upon the promotion and enhancement of an undesirable element in society. The egoism of him who is below mediocrity is a form of tyranny which leads to nothing, save, perhaps, a heaven where the hot fillet will consist of the whole scum and dross of humanity. Such egoism leads humanity downwards. It practically says, I, the bungled and the botched, I, the poor in spirit and body, I, the mean, despicable, and ugly, want my kind to be all-important, paramount, and on the top, I, the least desirable, wish to prevail. But this egoism would mean humanity's ruin, it would mean humanity's suicide and annihilation, it would certainly mean humanity's degradation. When such egoism says, I will have all, the only decent retort is deafness. When such egoism says, I have as much right to live and flourish as the well-constituted, the superior in spirit and body, the beautiful, and the happy, wisdom replies with a shrill of its shoulders. And when such egoism preaches altruism, then woe to all those who are tempted to practice one virtue more. Woe to humanity, woe to the whole world. There is, on the other hand, a form of egoism which is both virtuous and noble. It is the egoism of him whose multiplication would make the world better, more desirable, happier, healthier, superior in spirit and body. Egoism in such a case is a moral duty, wherever, in such a case, giving, bestowing, altruism, in fact, is not compatible with survival, then egoism becomes the highest principle of all, and it is in such circumstances that altruism may become a vice. Now let us hear Nietzsche's own words. Selfishness, he says, has as much value as the physiological value of him who possesses it. It may be very valuable or it may be vile and contemptible. Each individual may be looked at with respect to whether he represents an ascending or a descending line of life. When that is determined, we have a canon for determining the value of his selfishness. If he represent the ascent in the line of life, his value is in fact very great, and on account of the collective life which in him makes a further step, the concern about his maintenance, about providing his optimum of conditions, may even be extreme. If he represent descending development, decay, chronic degeneration, or sickening, he has little worth, and the greatest fairness would have him take away as little as possible from the well-constituted. He is then no more than their parasite. 12. This is all clear enough, but it is quite conceivable that a misunderstanding of it might lead to the most perverted notions of what Nietzsche actually stood for, and when I hear people inveighing against the so-called egoism of his teaching and declaring it poisonous on that account, I often wonder whether they have really made any attempt at all to comprehend the above passage, and whether there is not perhaps something wrong with language itself, that a thought which to some seems expressed so clearly and unmistakably should still prove confusing and incomprehensible to others, speaking once more to higher men than Nietzsche tells them, with some reason on his side, that altruism may be their greatest danger, that altruism may be even their greatest temptation, that there are times when they must avoid it as they would avoid a plague. In periods of gestation, when plans and dreams of plans for the elevation of themselves and their fellows are taking shape in their minds, altruism may lure them sideways, it may make them diverge from their path, and it may make mankind one great thought the poorer. In this sense alone, does our author deprecate the altruistic virtues. But again, I venture to remind readers that it is the simplest thing on earth to awaken suspicion against him by declaring, as some have declared, that his deprecation of altruism applies to all. No greater nonsense could be talked about Nietzsche than to say that he preached universal egoism. Universal egoism, as opposed to select egoism, is behind all the noisiest movements today. It is behind socialism, democracy, anarchy, and nihilism, but it is not behind Nietzscheism, and nobody who reads him with care could ever think so. With these observations in mind, we can read the following passages from Thus Spake Zarathustra without either surprise or indignation. Indeed, we may even learn a new valuation from them, which will alter our whole outlook on life, though no such sudden revulsion of feeling need necessarily follow a study of Nietzsche's doctrine. Only when we have given his thoughts time to become linked up and coordinated in our minds are we likely to find that our view of the world has become in the least degree transformed. Do I advise you to love your neighbor? Leather, do I advise you to flee from your neighbor and to love the most remote? Higher than love to your neighbor is love unto the most remote future. Man, it is the more remote, your children and your children's children, who pay for your love unto your neighbor. 13. Your children's land ye shall love, be this love your new nobility, the land undiscovered and the remotest sea, for it I bid your sails seek and seek. In your children ye shall make amends for being the children of your fathers, all the past shall ye thus redeem, this new table do I place over you. 14. 1z, chap. LXI, 2z, p. 299, 3, z, pp. 256, 257, 4, g, e, aph, 188. 5z, pp. 247, 248, 6, g, e, p. 223, 7, Antichrist, aph, 57, 8. The big pine is more often shaken by the winds, the higher a tower, the heavier is the fall thereof, and it is the tops of the mountains that the lightning strikes. 9. Antichrist, aph, 210, z, pp, 104, 105, 11, z, p, 105, 12, the twilight of the idols. Par 10, aph, 33, 13, z, pp, 69, 70, 14, z, p, 248, summary and conclusion, when we have done rubbing our eyes and ears at the dazzling and startling novelty of all we have seen and heard, let us ask ourselves, calmly and dispassionately, what sort of man this is who has led us thus far into regions which, from their very unfamiliarity and exoticness, may have seemed to us both unpleasant and forbidding. This is no time for apologetics or for pleading extenuating circumstances. Even if Nietzsche's doctrines have been presented in a form too undiluted to be inviting, it would scarcely mend matters now to beg pardon for them, and I have no intention of doing anything of the sort. But these questions may be put without any fear of assuming a penitential attitude, and I do not hesitate to put them. Was the promise of Nietzsche's life fulfilled? Did the task he started out with, the elevation of the type man, receive his best strength, his best endeavors, his sincerest application? However fundamentally we may disagree with his conclusions, were they reached by means of an upright attempt at grappling with the problems? To all of those questions there is but one answer, and that answer clears Nietzsche of all the slander and calumny to which he has been submitted for the last 30 years. However often we may think he has erred, it is nonsense any longer to speak of him as an anarchist, an advocate of brutality, a supporter of immorality in its worst modern sense, and a guardian saint of savage passions. If I have led any readers to suspect that he was all this, I can only entreat them to turn as soon as possible to the original works themselves, and there they will find that it was I who was wrong. Personally, I believe, as Hippolyte Taine, Dr. George Brandes, and Wagner believed, that Nietzsche's work is greater than his own or the next generation could ever suspect. Questions such as art, the future of science, and the future of religion, which Nietzsche treats with his customary skill, I have been unable to find room for in this work. But in each of these departments, I believe, and in this belief I am by no means alone, that Nietzsche's speculations may prove of the very highest value. Already in biology, there are signs that Nietzsche's conclusions are gaining ground. In art, as I hope to able to show elsewhere, his doctrines are likely to affect a salutary revolution. While in the departments of history, psychology, jurisprudence, and metaphysics, specialists will doubtless arise who will attempt to make innovations under his leadership. For the present, though the outlook is brighter than it was, Nietzscheism, that is to say, free-spiritedness, intellectual bravery, the ability to stand alone when everyone else has his arm linked in, something, the courage to face unpleasant, fatal, and disconcerting truths has not much hope of very general acceptance among those to whom it really ought to appeal. Calumny, which had a long start, has deafened many to the cause and will continue deafening a larger number, still, until the truth is ultimately known. Yet it is to be hoped that readers may learn to be less satisfied than they have been heretofore, with second-hand accounts of what Nietzsche stood for, and that very shortly everybody who is interested in the matter will be able to reply to the slanderer with facts culled from Nietzsche's life and works. "Mine enemies have grown strong," says Zarathustra, "and I have disfigured the face of my teaching so that my dearest friends have to blush for the gifts I gave them. One, but like a wind I shall one day blow amidst them and take away their breath with my spirit, thus my future willeth it. Verily a strong wind is Zarathustra to all lowlands and his enemies, and everything that spitteth and speweth he counselleth with such advice, beware of spitting against the wind. 2, 1, z, pp. 95-96, 2, z, p. 116, books useful to the student of Nietzsche, biographies, Das Leben Friedrich Nietzsches, by Mrs. Förster Nietzsche, Erinnerungen and Friedrich Nietzsche, by Diessen, Nietzsche, Sein Leben und Sein Werk, by Raoul Richter, editions of works, the complete works of Friedrich Nietzsche, edited by Dr. Oscar Levy. The first complete and authorized English translation. T. N. Foolies, 21 Paternoster Square, Friedrich Nietzsche's work. Library edition, 15 vols. Pocket edition, very good, 10 vols. Monographs, Baillart, Nietzsche's Ethic, Nietzsche's Metaphysic, Nietzsche und Richard Wagner Brands G., Mention und Work, Common Those, Nietzsche as Critic, Fouillet A., Nietzsche et l'Immoralisme, Me, Gaultier J., Descant and Nietzsche, Nietzsche et la Réforme Philosophique, Kennedy J. M. The Quintessence of Nietzsche, Lichtenberger, H., La Philosophie de Nietzsche, Moog, Nietzsche, His Life and Works, Sierra Leo, On the Tracks of Life, Tynes, Nietzsche's Stellung zu den Grundfragen der Ethik Genetisch Dargestellt, Till, A. von Darwin bis Nietzsche, Zeitler, J., Nietzsche's Aesthetik, Nietzsche's WORKS, authorized version, edited by Dr. Oscar Levy, Thoughts Out of Season, 2 vols, The Birth of Tragedy, Thus Spake Zarathustra, Beyond Good and Evil, The Future of Our Educational Institutions, Human, All Too Human, Vol. I, The Will to Power, 2 vols, The Genealogy of Morals, The Case Against Wagner, The Joyful Wisdom, The Dawn of Day, End of the Life and Works of Nietzsche, End of the Project, GUTNBRGEBOOK Nietzsche, His Life and Works asterisk, updated editions will replace the previous one, the old editions will be renamed, creating the works from print editions not protected by U.S. copyright. Law means that no one owns a United States copyright in these works, so the foundation and you can copy and distribute it in the United States without permission and without paying copyright royalties. Special rules set forth in the general terms of use part of this license apply to copying and distributing project Gutenberg trademark electronic works to protect the project GUTMBRGTM concept and trademark. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark and may not be used if you charge for an ebook, except by following the terms of the trademark license, including paying royalties for use of the Project Gutenberg trademark. If you do not charge anything for copies of this ebook, complying with the trademark license is very easy. You may use this ebook for nearly any purpose, such as creation of derivative works, reports, performances, and research. Project Gutenberg ebooks may be modified and printed and given away. You may do practically anything in the United States with ebooks not protected by U.S. copyright law. Redistribution is subject to the trademark license, especially commercial redistribution. Start, full license, the full Project GUTMBRGTM license. Please read this before you distribute or use this work to protect the Project Gutenberg trademark mission of promoting the free distribution of electronic works by using or distributing this work or any other work associated in any way with the phrase Project Gutenberg. You agree to comply with all the terms of the full Project Gutenberg license available with this file or online at www.gutenberg.org/license. Section 1. General Terms of Use and Redistributing Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. 1. A. By reading or using any part of this project Gutenberg, electronic work, you indicate that you have read, understand, agree to, and accept all the terms of this license and intellectual property. Trademark copyright agreement. If you do not agree to abide by all the terms of this agreement, you must cease using and return or destroy all copies of Project Gutenberg electronic works in your possession. If you paid a fee for obtaining a copy of or access to a Project Gutenberg electronic work and you do not agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement, you may obtain a refund from the person or entity to whom you paid the fee as set forth in paragraph 1E8(1)(b). Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark. It may only be used on or associated in any way with an electronic work by people who agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement. There are a few things that you can do with most Project Gutenberg electronic works, even without complying with the full terms of this agreement. See paragraph 1C below. There are a lot of things you can do with Project Gutenberg electronic works if you follow the terms of this agreement and help preserve free future access to Project Gutenberg electronic works. See paragraph 1E below 1C. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the Foundation or PGLAF, owns a compilation copyright in the collection of Project Gutenberg electronic works. Nearly all the individual works in the collection are in the public domain in the United States. If an individual work is unprotected by copyright law in the United States and you are located in the United States, we do not claim a right to prevent you from copying, distributing, performing, displaying, or creating derivative works based on the work as long as all references to Project Gutenberg are removed. Of course, we hope that you will support the Project Gutenberg mission of promoting free access to electronic works by freely sharing Project Gutenberg works in compliance with the terms of this agreement for keeping the Project Gutenberg name associated with the work. You can easily comply with the terms of this agreement by keeping this work in the same format with its attached full Project Gutenberg license when you share it without charge with others. 1D. The copyright laws of the place where you are located also govern what you can do with this work. Copyright laws in most countries are in a constant state of change. If you are outside the United States, check the laws of your country in addition to the terms of this agreement before downloading, copying, displaying, performing, distributing or creating derivative works based on this work or any other Project Gutenberg work. The Foundation makes no representations concerning the copyright status of any work in any country other than the United States. 1E. Unless you have removed all references to Project Gutenberg. 1E1. The following sentence, with active links to or other immediate access to the full Project Gutenberg license, must appear prominently whenever any copy of a Project Gutenberg work, any work, on which the phrase Project Gutenberg appears or with which the phrase Project Gutenberg is associated, is accessed, displayed, performed, viewed, copied, or distributed. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg trademark license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. 1E2. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is derived from texts not protected by U.S. copyright law, does not contain a notice indicating that it is posted with permission of the copyright holder, the work can be copied and distributed to anyone in the United States without paying any fees or charges. If you are redistributing or providing access to a work with the phrase Project Gutenberg associated with or appearing on the work, you must comply either with the requirements of paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 or obtain permission for the use of the work and the Project Gutenberg trademark as set forth in paragraphs 1E8 or 1E9, 1E3. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is posted with the permission of the copyright holder, your use and distribution must comply with both paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 and any additional terms imposed by the copyright holder. Additional terms will be linked to the Project Gutenberg license for all works posted with the permission of the copyright holder found at the beginning of this work. 1E4. Do not unlink or detach or remove the full Project Gutenberg license terms from this work or any files containing a part of this work or any other work associated with Project Gutenberg. 1E5. Do not copy, display, perform, distribute, or redistribute this electronic work or any part of this electronic work without prominently displaying the sentence set forth in paragraph 1E1 with active links or immediate access to the full terms of the project. Gutenberg License 1E6. You may convert to and distribute this work in any binary, compressed, marked up, non-proprietary or proprietary form, including any word processing or hypertext form. However, if you provide access to or distribute copies of a Project Gutenberg work in a format other than plain vanilla ASCII or other format used in the official version posted on the official Project Gutenberg website, www.gutenberg.org, you must, at no additional cost, fee, or expense, to the user provide a copy, a means of exporting a copy, or a means of obtaining a copy upon request of the work in its original plain vanilla ASCII or other form. Any alternate format must include the full Project Gutenberg license as specified in paragraph 1E1, 1E7. Do not charge a fee for access to, viewing, displaying, performing, copying, or distributing any Project Gutenberg works, unless you comply with paragraph 1E8 or 1E9, 1E8. You may charge a reasonable fee for copies of or providing access to or distributing Project Gutenberg electronic works, provided that you pay a royalty fee of 20% of the gross profits you derive from the use of Project Gutenberg works calculated using the method you already use to calculate your applicable taxes. The fee is owed to the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, but he has agreed to donate royalties under this paragraph to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Royalty payments must be paid within 60 days following each date on which you prepare or are legally required to prepare your periodic tax returns. Royalty payments should be clearly marked as such and sent to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation at the address specified in Section 4, Information about Donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. You provide a full refund of any money paid by a user who notifies you in writing or by email within 30 days of receipt that s/he does not agree to the terms of the full Project Gutenberg trademark license. You must require such a user to return or destroy all copies of the works possessed in a physical medium and discontinue all use of and all access to other copies of Project Gutenberg trademark works. You provide, in accordance with paragraph 1F3, a full refund of any money paid for a work or a replacement copy if a defect in the electronic work is discovered and reported to you within 90 days of receipt of the work. You comply with all other terms of this agreement for free distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark works. 1E9. If you wish to charge a fee or distribute a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work or group of works on different terms than are set forth in this agreement, you must obtain permission in writing from the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the manager of the Project Gutenberg trademark. Contact the foundation as set forth in section 3 below, 1F1F1. Project Gutenberg volunteers and employees expend considerable effort to identify, do copyright research on, transcribe, and proofread works not protected by U.S. copyright law in creating the Project Gutenberg trademark collection. Despite these efforts, Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works and the medium on which they may be stored may contain defects, such as, but not limited to, incomplete, inaccurate, or corrupt data, transcription errors, a copyright or other intellectual property infringement, a defective or damaged disk or other medium, a computer virus or computer codes that damage or cannot be read by your equipment. 1F2. Limited warranty disclaimer of damages, except for the right of replacement or refund described in paragraph 1F3, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, and any other party distributing a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work under this agreement, disclaim all liability to you for damages, costs, and expenses, including legal fees. You agree that you have no remedies for negligence, strict liability, breach of warranty, or breach of contract, except those provided in paragraph 1F3. You agree that the foundation, THE, trademark owner, and any distributor under this agreement will not be liable to you for actual, direct, indirect, consequential, punitive or Incidental damages, even if you give notice of the possibility of such damage. 1. F3. Limited right of replacement or refund. If you discover a defect in this electronic work within 90 days of receiving it, you can receive a refund of the money, if any, you paid for it by sending a written explanation to the person you received the work from. If you receive the work on a physical medium, you must return the medium with your written explanation. The person or entity that provided you with the defective work may elect to provide a replacement copy in lieu of a refund. If you receive the work electronically, the person or entity providing it to you may choose to give you a second opportunity to receive the work electronically in lieu of a refund. If the second copy is also defective, you may demand a refund in writing. Without further opportunities to fix the problem. 1. F4. Except for the limited right of replacement or refund set forth in paragraph 1 F3, this work is provided to you as is with no other WRNTIS of any kind, express or implied, including but not limited to WRNTIS of MERC Chanti BLATY or fitness for any purpose. 1. F5. Some states do not allow disclaimers of certain implied warranties or the exclusion or limitation of certain types of damages. If any disclaimer or limitation set forth in this agreement violates the law of the state applicable to this agreement, the agreement shall be interpreted to make the maximum disclaimer or limitation permitted by the applicable state law. The invalidity or unenforceability of any provision of this agreement shall not void the remaining provisions. 1. F6. Indemnity. You agree to indemnify and hold the foundation, the trademark owner, any agent or employee of the foundation, anyone providing copies of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works in accordance with this agreement, and any volunteers associated with the production, promotion, and distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works, harmless from all liability, costs, and expenses, including legal fees that arise directly or indirectly from any of the following which you do or cause to occur. A distribution of this or any Project Gutenberg work, b. alteration, modification, or additions or deletions to any Project Gutenberg work, and c. any defect you cause. Section 2. Information about the mission of Project Gutenberg. Project Gutenberg is synonymous with the free distribution of electronic works in formats readable by the widest variety of computers, including obsolete, old, middle-aged, and new computers. It exists because of the efforts of hundreds of volunteers and donations from people in all walks of life. Volunteers and financial support to provide volunteers with the assistance they need are critical to reaching Project Gutenberg goals and ensuring that the Project Gutenberg collection will remain freely available for generations to come. In 2001, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation was created to provide a secure and permanent future for Project Gutenberg and future generations. To learn more about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation and how your efforts and donations can help, see Sections 3 and 4 and the Foundation Information page at www.gutenberg.org, Section 3. Information about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation is a nonprofit 501(c)(3) educational corporation organized under the laws of the state of Mississippi and granted tax-exempt status by the Internal Revenue Service. The foundation's EIN or federal tax identification number is 64622-1541. Contributions to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation are tax deductible to the full extent permitted by U.S. federal laws and your state's laws. The foundation's business office is located at 41 Watchung Plaza 516, Montclair, NJ 7042, USA, plus 1-862-621-9288. Email contact links and up. To date contact information can be found at the foundation's website, an official page at www.gutenberg.org/contact. Section 4. Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Project Gutenberg trademark depends upon and cannot survive without widespread public support and donations to carry out its mission of increasing the number of public domain and licensed works that can be freely distributed in machine-readable form accessible by the widest array of equipment, including outdated equipment. Many small donations $1 to $5,000, are particularly important to maintaining tax-exempt status with the IRS. The foundation is committed to complying with the laws regulating charities and charitable donations in all 50 states of the United States. Compliance requirements are not uniform, and it takes a considerable effort, much paperwork, and many fees to meet and keep up with these requirements. We do not solicit donations in locations where we have not received written confirmation of compliance. To send donations or determine the status of compliance for any particular state, visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. While we cannot and do not solicit contributions from states where we have not met the solicitation requirements, we know of no prohibition against accepting unsolicited donations from donors in such states who approach us with offers to donate. International donations are gratefully accepted, but we cannot make any statements concerning tax treatment of donations received from outside the United States. U.S. laws alone swamp our small staff. Please check the Project Gutenberg web pages for current donation methods and addresses. Donations are accepted in a number of other ways, including checks, online payments, and credit card donations. To donate, please visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. Section 5. General information about Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. Professor Michael S. Hart was the originator of the Project Gutenberg concept of a library of electronic works that could be freely shared with anyone. For 40 years, he produced and distributed Project Gutenberg ebooks with only a loose network of volunteer support. Project Gutenberg ebooks are often created from several printed editions, all of which are confirmed as not protected by copyright in the U.S. unless a copyright notice is included. Thus, we do not necessarily keep ebooks in compliance with any particular paper edition. Most people start at our website, which has the main PG search facility, www.gutenberg.org. This website includes information about Project Gutenberg, including how to make donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, how to help produce our new ebooks, and how to subscribe to our email newsletter to hear about new ebooks. This is the end of the audiobook. Thank you for listening. You can listen to and download more audiobooks at threeords.com.